The following podcast of the STR radio program is made possible through the generous support of our listeners. You can support this podcast by going to str.org and making a donation today.
I'm completely operational and all my circuits are functioning perfectly.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, and boy, glad to be with you today. Looking forward to having conversations, in fact, with you as you give us a ring. 1-800-227-5278 is the number if you're in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Just got off the plane last night. I want to tell you about what I did yesterday, conversations I had. That convinced me more and more that not only is Christianity worth thinking about, not only that Christianity can compete in the marketplace of ideas, but when I hear the alternate views, I am just taken by how much more plausible the Christian worldview is than anything else, certainly atheism, which was a topic of discussion yesterday. I got off the plane last night, actually 3 hours earlier than I anticipated. I was flying back from Vancouver, Canada, left on Friday afternoon, flew in, had dinner, then did three sessions at a conference in Vancouver yesterday. Got back to the airport about 2 hours before my flight, noticed that there was a flight leaving in 20 minutes nonstop for L.A. instead of mine leaving in 2 hours, and it stopped off in San Francisco with an hour layover. So I hopped onto it. And by the time I got home, went out to dinner with my wife, crawled into bed, and started falling asleep, I looked at the clock and realized if I was on my original flight, I'd still be in the air. And I live an hour from the airport. So that was kind of satisfying to beat that rap a little bit last night. But the most satisfying thing yesterday was interacting with some wonderful folks there in Vancouver, Canada. It's the second time I've been up there recently, and I was there March of this year, and then asked back to do another conference with Apologetics Canada. That's Andy Steiger and his great bunch doing a sensational job in Vancouver, standing for the Lord. And, you know, one of the reasons they had, in a way, it was frustrating for them. It has been, in a certain sense, kind of frustrating for them promoting events like this because people don't even know what apologetics is there. And the idea of defending your faith and that kind of notion, thoughtful Christianity, Christianity we're thinking about, this is new to them up there. But so introducing people to the notion when they're promoting it takes a little time and explanation. But once people get it, they come out in droves. We had a great turnout yesterday, much like we had in the spring, in March there. And it just goes to show, as I've said before, that there is a what I call a third wave of movement of the Holy Spirit in the lives of people, and this is a wave of thoughtful Christianity. That's the boots on the ground kind of wave. These are the people in the local church. This is where it's happening and spreading massively among the rank and file. Now, of course, there's lots of ground to cover. This is just the beginning. But by comparison to what it's been in the past, I see a magnificent response by people. And here in Vancouver, where apologetics was unheard of, when people realize what it is, that is that you can think about your Christian faith, you can have confidence in your convictions, you can employ reason to properly assess the things that you put your trust in. That's the reason faith balance. I'll talk about this more at the beginning of next hour because, I was at an event earlier in the week where we talked about this. I want to bring that up to you, but that'll be at the beginning of next hour. Anyway, when people realize that this is possible, this is part of the Christian tradition. We had people in the past that said, you know, they come to our events and they say, gee, I didn't even know you could think like this. I didn't know it was okay to do this kind of thing when they realize this, people come out of the woodwork. People are excited. People respond. And we've been seeing this all over the country, and yesterday was just another example of that kind of thing. I did have a conversation, though, I want to share with you because it's instructive, and that was at the conference yesterday. A young man came up to me and raised an issue about the problem of evil. He was with a Christian family that was there. His mom and dad were committed Christians, and he's been raised in this family, but is at a point in his life, understandably, where he's wondering whether this is really right, and has had exposure to other ideas that have provided a challenge. And now he identifies himself as an atheist agnostic. That is, that he is atheistic, but, you know, not entirely deeply committed is the way I took the characterization. And open to discussion, which is why he's talking with some of the folks there, and why he sat down during the break and had a conversation with me over lunch, during the lunchtime. And we spoke for maybe 15 or 20 minutes. And I was happy to hear his complaint and his concern, and to try to give him something worth thinking about, because this is the stage in life that young people do that kind of thing. They're raised with a point of view, they're exposed to differences, and they have to make a transition from adopting their parents' beliefs because their parents said so, which, by the way, is a fairly reasonable way of justifying beliefs when you're young. I believe it because mommy and daddy told me so. Well, that's perfectly fine at that stage, but eventually you grow out of that. You need more. And that's where he's at. I think he's just out of high school, so maybe 18, 19, right, in that age bracket. And so his parents are not losing it. They're not pulling their hair out. They're not panicking. They were there as a family at the event yesterday, and he listened to the presentations, with an open mind, and his parents are just letting him work through it, which is exactly what needs to happen. And as Josh McDowell said to his son, Sean, when Sean raised questions like this to his own dad, Josh said, well, I'm glad you're struggling with this, and this is a good sign because it shows you care about truth. And the important thing is that you not believe your father's viewpoint because it's your father's viewpoint, but rather because it's true. And you not reject your father's viewpoint because it's your father's viewpoint, but rather because it's false. And so Josh gave Sean the space to work through these issues. And as a result, Sean is one of the brightest, brightest voices, if you will, in the area of Christian apologetics today. A fabulous individual and a fine thinker and communicator as well. We worked on many things together. And so here is a young man going through this, and he has some questions. And so he raises, initially at least, the question of the problem of evil or some form of it that gets us into the discussion. And this is one of the things that has given him pause with regards to the Christian worldview. Now, I can't remember exactly how this happened, but we didn't stay on that problem for long. We came back to it later, but something else happened. And I think he was mentioning that this gave him pause, but then he offered his own kind of thesis. And what he said was this. He said that I think that there are better arguments for atheism than for theism, and that naturalism is a better explanation for things. Now, I appreciated that he made his point, or he expressed his own conviction so clearly. It was beneficial for me because now I was aware of exactly where he was, and to some degree, at least in principle, why he was there. He thought the arguments were better, and these were his words. The arguments for atheism are better, and naturalism provides a better explanation for the way things are. Now, just to bring you up to speed, naturalism is a metaphysical view. It is a worldview. Metaphysical views are views that tell you what's real. What is the nature of reality? And naturalism is kind of its synonym is physicalism, I guess you could say, though they're a little different. They amount to the same thing for our purposes. that the only thing that exists is the physical world that is governed by natural law, largely the laws of physics and chemistry. That naturalism is the governance by natural law. Physicalism is the nature of things. Physical things exist. So where our worldview starts out in the beginning, God, their view starts out in the beginning, the particles and natural law. And so everything that happens to the particles can be explained ultimately with reference to natural law. And nothing else, plus nothing. So he thinks that there's powerful explanatory power in naturalism. Now I have a sense of what he's talking about, but I took a second just to, in a sense, repeat back to him his view, so I was sure I had it clear, though I added another word for clarification. I said, so what you're saying then is that naturalism and atheism are more plausible to you, all things considered. Now, of course, that's what he meant by better arguments for. It just seems, pardon me, more reasonable, more plausible. It just seems like this is a better explanation. Fine. Okay, that's great. I just want to nail it down, just bring that up, as it were, make it real clear that this is what your case is. All right, now I understand that. What comes next? If you are in that situation, what would come next for you? Now, this should come immediately to mind for those of you who've been around STR for a while. I was certainly willing to entertain that point of view as far as it went. But he made a claim, didn't he? And his claim was that atheism has better reasons in favor of it than does theism. So I asked a simple question. All right, I'm waiting. Tell me what your arguments for atheism are. Notice that little sounds of silence there? This is what I confronted. Because he paused for a moment and he's thinking. I only know, friends, I only know of one argument for atheism. I know that atheism really, more or less, is the default position of people who don't think there are good reasons for theism. But they don't give reasons for atheism proper. The only one that I know for atheism proper is the deductive argument from the problem of evil, because that argument says that atheism must be false in virtue of internal contradiction. Now, I don't think that argument goes through, but at least it is an argument in favor of atheism. I know of no other arguments in favor of atheism. All the other ways of looking at atheism or justifications for atheism are just taking shots at arguments for theism and saying that those arguments aren't adequate. And therefore, since the only alternative is unsupportable, then atheism is kind of the fallback position. And this is the direction he went. But notice that he said to me the arguments for atheism were better. And when I asked him, in a cordial conversation, it wasn't a sticking him with anything. I said, okay, I'm interested to hear your arguments for atheism. He did not give any. He didn't even pursue the deductive problem of evil at that point. He just simply said this. He said, well, if I can show you that God is not necessary for the universe to be the way it is, then that would be a point in favor of atheism. Now, his statement was 100% true. And I had no trouble agreeing with him on that point. Yes, if you can show me that naturalism can explain everything fine without any appeal to an immaterial, all-powerful God, then you're right. This does then seem to commend the atheistic worldview. And then there was another pause, because I was waiting to hear how he could do that. And here is my sense in the moment. It was almost as if he could just simply say that if I can show you it wasn't necessary to have God to explain the natural world, then that would be evidence for atheism. That all he needed to do was to say that, and well, that was it. Well, of course that's true, but that's a tautology, you know, almost. It doesn't help. That's like saying if there is no evidence for God, then there's no evidence for God. But then you have to show, you have to actually now step up and explain to me how it is that naturalism accounts for everything. And so then I asked him, okay, now I need to hear that. You've got to do more than this. I took a book out as an example. It was actually sitting there on the couch where we were talking, and I said, here's this book. Now, if you could explain to me in naturalistic terms how this book, purely naturalistic terms, without appealing to any agency whatsoever, any person's acting, any writer's writing, if you can appeal simply to the laws of physics and chemistry to explain how this book got there on the couch between us, and not just the book, the object got there, but how the book came to be, well, then, of course, it means that there is no reason to assert writers. But now you have to do the job of showing me and explaining to me in naturalistic terms entirely how the book happened to come to be on the, so go ahead. And it was another kind of Simon and Garfunkel Sounds of Silence moment. So he kind of pondered this, and as a young man, and I didn't want at all to beat up on him or have him feel that way. That wasn't my attitude either, but I did want to hold his feet to the fire. Okay, now you're going to say these things. Okay, what's next? It's your turn. Now you got to show me these things. And then I asked him, how is it that the world, universe, explain to me how the universe came to be by naturalistic, in naturalistic terms. The problem with the universe coming into existence by naturalistic means is that the thing that came into existence was nature itself and all of its laws and the physical universe at the singularity called the Big Bang. Now, if the universe came into existence at that point, it could hardly be something natural prior to the natural world that caused it to happen. So I think he's at odds right there with a naturalistic explanation. And he knew where I was going. This is the Kalam cosmological argument in one form or another. A big bang needs a big banger. That's the simple way of putting it. And he said, well, you know, that's where you're going, to the Kalam argument, aren't you? I said, yes. He said, but you're assuming now the uniformity of cause and effect. That is, that all effects require causes adequate to the effect. You're assuming that, Greg. Yes, I am. And why not? Is that an illicit assumption here? Since our universal experience is that all effects have causes, since the entire scientific enterprise depends upon the uniformity of cause and effect, is it unreasonable for me to expect it to play a part even at the Big Bang? Because if you think about it, cause and effect isn't just about physical things. Strictly speaking, you could think, you could imagine an immaterial spirit thinking, that is, willing thoughts, and therefore the thoughts are the effect that are caused by the agent, the spirit thinking. So cause and effect seems to work even in the immaterial realm. I have no reason to think that it's locked in here. So he's identifying an assumption I'm making as if the assumption were a liability of my argument, but of course it's not at all. It's an entirely reasonable assumption. It's part of was one of the tools that I have to help assess my environment, my world, and figure it out. So why not use it here, especially since my experience with cause and effect knows no exceptions. And he said, well, how do you have a cause before time? And I talked about this a couple of weeks ago because Stephen Hawking has raised this objection. And my response is that if you say there's can't be any causes before time, you're assuming physicalism, the point of view that's in question. Because even though there is physical time that starts at the Big Bang, this doesn't mean that there can't be any metaphysical time before the Big Bang. And I talked about this at length a few months ago. So you can check it out on our website if you want to listen to that podcast. So I'm not going to go into the details here, but simply put, there's no reason why there can't be metaphysical time before physical time, in which a cause happens of which the effect is the universe. So this doesn't help you. The only way you can invoke this against me is if you assume your view that's circular. And he saw that right away. And this is a, you know, my hat tips to him because he was willing to, see the reasonableness of my responses. But I did mention one other thing, because his point of view was he wants to opt for a naturalistic explanation because he thinks it's adequate when he hasn't given me a naturalistic explanation for the beginning of all things and indeed is incapable of doing so. And then I said to him, you know, you cannot even explain to me through the laws of physics and chemistry how you happen to be talking to me right now. He says, what do you mean? I said, I know you can explain muscular movements and chemistry and all of that other stuff about the act of talking, but think about it. Just a few moments ago, you were sitting there still listening. And then your body started moving, your mouth started moving, your lips started forming words, and you began to communicate. From a position of stillness, you started moving. Now, the laws of physics say that objects at rest tend to stay at rest unless moved upon by an outside source. So what is the outside force, rather, that began moving your lips? It wasn't any natural law that dictated the initiation of his speaking to me. He did that. He chose to communicate. He's not just a domino, one of millions falling in sequence by natural law. No, he initiated that. So his system cannot even make sense of the agency that gets his mouth moving in having a conversation with me. I believe in natural laws. I just don't think they're capable of explaining everything, because I believe that there are agents, individual persons who make choices that can begin chains of events and can stop chains of events. And those persons are not subject in the same way as other physical things to natural law. So now we have a situation. His view, which he says can be explained best by naturalism, when it turns out that naturalism can't even explain the ordinary events of everyday life, many of them. My appeal is to cause and effect, which he faults me for assuming, yet there are no known clear cases where cause and effect isn't the issue. And by the way, if you're thinking about, well, quantum mechanics, well, that let's just say that's a highly contested area. Certainly not clear to me that you have effects without causes even in quantum mechanics. In fact, all of our experience should mitigate against that. Just because we don't know what the cause is doesn't mean there wasn't a cause. Doesn't mean the event wasn't uncaused. Was uncaused, rather. In any event, you see the flow of thinking here. And what I ended up with at the end of the conversation and let him have the last word, moved on to my lunch, and here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking that went pretty well. And what I mean by that is not that I aced him, not that I stuck him, not that I got a little notch in my spiritual belt, but that he raised objections and offered alternatives. And as I looked, I think, in a fair-minded way at the alternatives that laid themselves out, I was well within my rights to trust in the uniformity of cause and effect, which implies then, and I should say it implies, it dictates that there was some cause to the universe that was outside of the universe. Therefore, naturalism is defeated on its face. And yet what he countered with was another assumption, the assumption of naturalism, which is the very thing at issue, which naturalism isn't even capable of explaining how he happened to be talking with me that day. And I walked away from that feeling, we got a pretty good case here. We are on solid ground, because remember, his claim was that his view was more plausible. It wasn't just that it was possible. It was a better answer to the questions than ours. Really. I saw absolutely no reason that was given in that conversation why I should take that seriously. With all respect to the young man, he never gave me a reason, even though he said the reasons were much better on his side. I gave a reason, cause and effect, the Kalam cosmological argument. Now, maybe some people aren't impressed by that. It's a reason, though, and it's a good reason. It may not make the day for you, but it was a lot better in the conversation yesterday than the alternative that was offered me, which was nothing but an assertion. Anyway, I've talked too much here. It's your turn. Greg Kokel and Stan DeReason back with your calls after this.
Hi, Greg Kokel here, inviting you to a conference you won't soon forget. The location? The Eastern Caribbean. Join us as we set sail March 17th, 2012, from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for 8 days aboard Holland America's MS Eurodam for an unforgettable trip to Grand Turks and Caicos Islands, San Juan, Puerto Rico, St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas. I'll be joined by Stan DeReason Student Impact Director Brett Kunkel and STR speaker and trainer Alan Schliemann for a lineup of conference sessions that will stimulate your thinking and equip you with practical skills. Everything about this trip is being planned with your enjoyment and enrichment in mind. And this year we're planning some special youth sessions led by Brett, so plan on bringing the family and enjoying great times of fellowship and spiritual deepening together. Not only will you be challenged with stimulating presentations, you'll have a chance to ask questions in open forum discussions and enjoy the interaction and fellowship with both our speakers and your fellow passengers on deck, sharing great meals together and ashore as we enjoy the splendor of the Eastern Caribbean's beautiful resort ports. So save the dates and contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours. That's 800-247-1899. They're assisting Stan DeReason with their trip, and their skilled staff is committed to answering all your questions and helping to make this a memorable experience. You can also visit our website at str.org for all the information. I hope to see you there in the Caribbean with Stan DeReason.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. What do we do when our students doubt? What should be our response? And does Jesus have anything to say about doubt? Download my Bulletproof podcast this month to find out. Look for Bulletproof on iTunes or on the podcast page at str.org.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Greg's speaking events? What people are saying about STR resources? You can find STR on Facebook and follow STR on Twitter. Learn more about STR staff, post comments, and get involved with other like-minded Christians. On Facebook, you'll find the official Stand to Reason page, a Solid Ground fan page, and the STR Place Facebook home for student outreach. You can find them all connected at our official page. And finally, follow STR on Twitter at STR Tweets, where you can also engage other listeners live during the radio program using the hashtag STR Talk.
Kokel, Stand to Reason, giving you a piece of my mind today, as I do every Sunday. Two until five is the full show. Here in Southern California, Coast Street Blues, about 20 minutes. But on the rest of the network, we're on for the whole time. Let's take our first caller in from Colorado, in this case, Jack, or make it Jacob. Hey, Jacob.
It's actually Jason.
Oh, Jason. Okay, Jason.
No, it's no big deal.
All right, good. Glad to have you on board. What's up?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to ask you a question. I'd love to respond to some of the points you made in the last segment, but we can wait on that. Mm-hmm. But what I'd like to do is ask you a question about a good God. How could a good God send or allow Satan to come to earth to deceive his children?
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm referring to is when, you know, the devil was a serpent and deceived Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. God knowing beforehand what would happen
right.
And how it would turn out,
right.
Why would he allow something like that? And before you respond about saying free will, because that's quite often the response I get in regards to free will,
mm-hmm.
I'm not challenging free will, and I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with free will. God
mm-hmm.
could have allowed free will before without Satan being involved.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my question.
Well,
knowing the end result.
Yes, of course. However, in response to your comment about free will, I'm not going to advance that as my point. But if there were no Satan, the same objection could be raised regarding human freedom, and that is that that why did God allow man to sin when he knew man was going to use his freedom that way? It's really the same question, because it's just shifted over to Satan. Why did God allow another free moral agent to act the way he did when he knew what was going to happen and he could have stopped it? So the question, how is it different, just out of curiosity?
Yeah, the reason I would say it's different is because, like, let me give you an example. If I were to tell my children to not touch a candy jar that had candy in it, right?
Yeah.
And they could choose to obey me or not to obey me, right? But then if I added another element of a deceiver who was very skilled in deception and allowed them into the room with my child while I was away and allowed that person to deceive my children into mm-hmm. doing it, mm-hmm. then it adds another layer. And that's what I'm saying. It goes beyond just free will and the freedom issue. It goes beyond that.
No, but the reason I think that that's not a valid distinction here, and by the way, we're just kind of talking about that issue. It doesn't go here or there, basically. But the reason I think it's not exactly a valid distinction that you've just made is because the act of the devil to deceive is a function of the devil's own freedom, just like an act of a human being to deceive a child and hurt a child is a function of that human being's freedom. So it doesn't matter that the devil is a spiritual being only, and human beings are spiritual and physical. The same situation applies to both, because get rid of the devil, you still have human beings who deceive children into doing something that brings harm to those children, and so the exact same question could be raised. So I just don't see the distinction there, but I understand the question that you're raising. All right.
Yeah, and the reason I'm even bringing this up is because to talk about Satan is in a completely different level than talking about humans. Satan, you could compare him to a rapist or a murderer, a criminal. Right? God is allowing a criminal into the Garden of Eden to deceive his
children.
That's
right. Well, God allows all kinds of criminals in the human race to do all kinds of things like that as well. So, I mean, this is why I think the two are connected. The issue of freedom is connected there.
So you're saying it's the same between a human and Satan?
No, on the particular point you're making, I'm saying that the distinction here is irrelevant, because in both cases, you have God allowing a free will moral agent to come in and deceive other moral agents that suffer from their actions. If you didn't have Satan, you would still have exactly the same kind of complaint to be raised. But you don't have to agree with me on it, because this isn't the main point. But go ahead if you want to respond to that, and then I'll move on to my response to you.
Right. Well, the main point that I'm making is that to compare the freedom of Satan and what he did to the freedom of humanity and what they do seems disingenuous to me, because when you think about the devil, he's on a different level of deception. When God allowed Satan to come into the garden, he wasn't just allowing another human with influence. He was allowing Satan, who was cast out of heaven, you know, and having one third of the angels. And so to allow something like this,
don't go into the for instance, because we understand your point, okay? And my only response to that is, maybe I'm mistaken, maybe my thinking is bad, it's not disingenuous. Maybe that's the wrong word, you didn't mean to use that one, but I am very genuine in making my point. I'm not deceiving or cheating or anything, because I'm trying to being duplicitous here. It seems to me that they're essentially the same kind of thing, though different in degree. Qualitatively, they are the same. If you don't agree or other people don't agree, you're welcome to reject. That's fine. Let's get on to the main point. Let's get on to the main
degree.
Point. Pardon me?
Like you said, it could be different in degree, and I think that's the point that I'm making, is that it's very different in degree when a God would allow a devil.
I know, Jacob. I'm agreeing that it's different in degree, but the point. Okay, well, we've already gone over this ground. If there was no Satan, the same objection could be raised here with regards to human beings preying on other human beings, and that kind of praying is pretty bad. It's bad enough to raise the objection. So let me answer to let me give you the answer to the objection. The answer to the objection is that I don't know why God allowed. All I have the confidence in is that He has a morally sufficient reason for allowing it. And just because you wouldn't do that with your kids doesn't mean God doesn't have a better reason on the larger scale to allow that kind of thing to happen to humanity.
So you just pinpointed the main primary point of my objection, because within Christianity, we already have shown or told to us what the end result is, that the majority of humanity is going to hell. So when you say that God has a better plan in mind, or he has a greater goal, or he has something that he's working towards, that just seems completely wrong, because when we look at the end result, we see that the majority of humanity is going to burn.
So therefore, your conclusion is on this view, then, let's just accept your point that the majority is going to burn. Okay, I don't know if that's actually true, but let's just accept it at face value. If the majority wasn't going to burn, would that change your objection?
That would be much more moral.
Would it change your objection? Would you drop the objection if that were the case?
To a degree.
Okay, because had you said no, then your point would have been disingenuous in bringing
right.
it up. So to a degree, okay, you're still troubled by people going to hell and God knowing that, and why did he create them? And that's you know, a legitimate question to be raised. I actually don't know whether the majority or the minority are going to heaven or hell. I don't know that number, and neither does anybody else.
Doesn't the Bible clearly say that the narrow is the road that leads to eternal life and broad is the one that leads
yes,
to
that's
eternal
right.
death?
Jesus says that in Matthew 6, I believe, right.
So
well, that is true. The road is narrow.
Okay, so isn't it fair to say that the majority is going to eternal
understand,
death?
I understand the application of that passage. I'm not going to beef about that, okay? I think there's other ways to take that. And it looks like...
Well, what else? How
all right, you don't want to argue about that verse, do you? Or do you want an answer to your question? Do you want to face... let me do this, Jacob. Hold on just a second. Since I'm in charge here, you ask the question, I'm going to answer your question. We're not going to dance all over the landscape. And part of that is my fault because I started taking a side trail on this discussion. Here's my general response. And your point was that if more people go to hell than to heaven, then somehow this is a morally inferior system. Okay? Mm-hmm. And I don't see how that's the case unless you just simply assume that the greatest good in the grandest sense of things is that people end up in heaven rather than in hell. I'm not convinced that that's the case, because in both cases, the God who is the God of all creation gets glorified on the one hand for saving those who didn't deserve to be saved, and on the other hand, punishing those who deserve punishment. So whether more gets saved or less gets saved, this doesn't detract from God's character if God's character is a just character and he's properly punishing those who did wrong. Just like it's not, you can't say that it's a bad government simply because 90% of the people who are in jail who did bad. If there's more than half, it doesn't mean that the government is somehow bad or unjust. It just shows that the people themselves are bad and the government is good for punishing them.
Well, this is why it circles back around to the original question, because when you talk about the government, see, this system, the Christian system, is all-inclusive. And so God is
That's
also
right.
responsible for how it originally started. He's responsible for how the system, he's responsible for the rules, he's responsible for allowing the devil to the earth, and knowing that the end result would be negative. I would hold...
No, wait. Let me just pause for a second there. That last statement I'm not buying, and that's what I was just arguing against a moment ago. So you can't assert that in the case. That's up for grabs, that the end result is going to be negative. I don't think the end result is negative. Even if 90% of the people end up in hell, I don't think that's negative on the moral scale. That is negative for the 90%, but not on the grand moral scale if proper justice is being done.
So if I save 1,000 people and one person dies in the process, isn't that the greater good?
Yes, but this isn't parallel to our circumstance, because in the situation here, it isn't an innocent person dying. It is that people who are guilty are being punished for what they did wrong. That's the difference. And if it turns out that 90% of the people are guilty and they get punished for what they do wrong, then it is good for God to punish the guilty. That is a good thing, not a bad thing. That isn't an evil, ultimately evil end.
Right, and that's why I originally said that since God... Originally, okay, from the very beginning, there was nothing but God. And then he decided to create.
Yes.
He decided to not only create the humanity, but decided to create the system, the rules by which humanity would function.
Yeah, he didn't create the rules. They're expression of his character.
Okay, part of his character. So, but he knows the end from the beginning, exactly what's going to happen and how he's implementing his plan.
Right.
And so as he implements his plan, he creates humans that are fallible.
Wait. Okay, now you misstepped here because that's not the Christian view. He doesn't create humans that are fallible. He created human beings who are morally pure but had the capability of making of deviating from moral purity, and that's human choice. They chose to do that. He knew that they were going to do that, but it wasn't an inevitability.
Don't Christians, aren't they born with the sin nature?
Well, Christians are as a result of Adam's sin, but that just means that man caused other human beings trouble. The problem isn't the way God created man. It is what man has done to man.
So
that's the distinction.
Every person that's born is born with a sin nature, correct?
Since Adam, that's correct.
Okay. So God, when he implemented this plan, instead of allowing Adam to be responsible for his own sin, he implemented a plan, knowing beforehand, that people would be born with this sin nature.
The end result
of this plan would that most people would be eternally tormented.
Okay, for the sake of discussion, I'll accept that for now, right? Most people will be punished for the crimes that they freely chose to commit. Even under the influence of their sin nature, they were still guilty. It doesn't make them any less guilty.
And this is the point that I've been making all along, is that it's not just an equal opportunity of free will to choose the good or the evil. As soon as a person is born, they are automatically already, the scales are tipped against them.
That's right.
So that because they have the sin nature, the scales are tipped against them.
That's right.
And so here we have an unfair balance. It's not just free will. It's not the free will to choose the good or the evil.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually tipped so that you will tend to choose the evil.
Yeah,
what is the system that God implemented that he knew most people would burn in hell forever?
Jacob,
is that not immoral?
Yeah, what you're identifying, I think, is the trickiest part of Christian theology. You put your finger right on it, all right? And this is why when you raised the question and I offered you my fairly straightforward but maybe overly simplistic answer for you, that I don't know the reason that God provided all of these things or allowed this to take place, but I wasn't willing to ascribe injustice to him or immorality to him for other reasons. I said that rather than anything else because this is something that I understand is a little bit of an imponderable to us. Okay.
Right.
Part of what I have to look at, though, is not just the things that I don't entirely understand, but I have to look at the things that I do understand, and I have to look at the alternatives. So what are the alternatives that are present to me in terms of worldviews that are more believable given all of the evidence? And I have no other alternatives. This one, and especially in terms of clarifying to me the goodness of God, the majesty of God, and the mercy of God, is far and above all the rest of them in terms of their evidential power. Certainly atheism doesn't even come close to this for me. Let me just finish the sentence, and I'll let you jump in and have the last word. If you ask me a question, by the way, I'm going to answer it. So if you just want to give me the last word and make your statement, we'll move on. But what I'm faced with, as with every worldview, you have questions that are difficult to answer, and there are loose ends, and you have to make your best assessment based on all the information that you have. So I am fully comfortable saying to you, you know what, you've touched on a point that even I have wondered and pondered about myself, but just because I haven't answered the question for this doesn't make the system collapse at my feet because of the soundness of the reasons that I have for the system in general, and that there are no other alternative that comes even close. So what I'm going to do is to trust that maybe God knows a few more things about this particular issue than I do. So your final word?
All right. So what I would challenge you to is that if there is an issue or a problem with your worldview, instead of just accepting it, that you have a moral responsibility to say, no, that's not right, and I'm going to stand for what I know is right, instead of choosing a worldview because you don't like the alternative or because you're not willing to say, I don't know.
No.
The best thing to say would be, say, I don't know maybe even who God is, or maybe he's not the Christian God, but to say I don't know is much better than accepting the immorality that you have already said concerns you and leaves you with questions.
Yeah.
So,
well, Okay, I understand what you're saying, and it strikes me that I'm doing exactly what you're saying. I said I don't know. I say I agree that there's appearance like this of this, but I have other evidence to the contrary within my own worldview. So I have to take the worldview as a whole. It isn't like I'm just taking a blind leap of faith, and I don't understand any of this, it doesn't make any sense, but I'm just going to believe. I am doing the epistemologically responsible thing by considering all of these things. The alternatives are no less appealing. Let me just tell you that. Because when it comes to atheism, there is no problem of evil that you can make any sense of whatsoever. In that case, I am stuck with a much bigger moral dilemma. How could it be that all of the things that seem to be deeply evil in the world have no moral content at all, and all of the things that seem to be deeply virtuous have no objective moral content at all? And there is no answer for that in atheism.
This is a very simple atheistic answer for that. And that's the same answer I give for an earthquake. You know, just because somebody gets horribly dismembered or disfigured by an earthquake or killed doesn't mean that we're going to put moral responsibility on that earthquake. It's a painful experience.
Okay.
But it does not leave us
That's exactly the only response the atheist has. That is the relativistic answer. That is that there is no evil or good. We just describe it as painful and leave it as that. But that, frankly, is not morally responsible from where I sit. And that's the alternative that I'm faced with rather than dealing with the issue that you've pointed out. So, Jason, I thank you for your call. And I got to run. I think, am I over for break? Yes, I am. And then I'll come back to some other calls in just a moment here on Stand to Reason. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions no matter who you're talking to by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material too by using the brand new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org. or call 1-800-2-REASON.
My name is Alan Schliemann, but recently I was introduced as Saeed Ibn Umar to a group of Christians who thought I was a real Muslim. During my role play, I fired off the most common Islamic arguments to see if they were prepared to answer the Muslim challenge. Find out how they did in this month's podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Look for it on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Now you can take STR with you through the new apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad. Available for free from iTunes or the Android market, you can listen to STR podcasts, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letter, and much, much more. You can also follow STR on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed and created by the group that has created apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you'll be pleased with the clean layout, the great features and functionality of the STR apps. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new STR app by posting a review on iTunes or the Android market. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Spring. You are the sun that summertime brings. You are the stars in the nighttime sky. You are my girl and I'm your guy.
Where did that come from? Greg Kokel here at Stand to Reason. I was just thinking about my last conversation with Jason there, who was it just struck me during the break that he was speaking as if there was something genuinely morally questionable about the Christian view, which, by the way, I understand the objection as you notice. I'm sympathetic to that. But it was just the way notice that the objection was based on a genuine moral concern. There's something deeply immoral about this. But then when we talked about the nature of morality from his own perspective, I can answer that simply. You know, it's just relativism is what he offered. He described morality in completely relativistic terms. So I guess sometimes the objection against Christianity is within your system you have an apparent contradiction, and that's all that people are saying. Maybe that was his point. If he is complaining that our system is genuinely immoral, which is the way it sounded to me, and then he explains to me how he understands morality in purely relativistic terms, as a mere description of painful feelings about things, not as if we should ascribe moral wrong to something, well, then that doesn't make any sense of his objection then. At any event, let's go to San Ramon, California. And Andy, thank you for waiting. Andy, hi.
Hey, Greg, how you doing?
Doing okay. Are you on the phone or on a speaker or what?
Yeah, no, I got you. I was off Bluetooth, just hanging on.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you, Andy. What's up?
All righty. So I have a question regarding, let's see here, I want to read it to you because I spent some time to articulate it. Okay, it's like a threefold question.
All right.
All right. Question is, how would you define non-essential, secondary, open-handed, and I'm going to quote, non-divide the body over doctrines?
Okay, let me answer that first because I'm looking at time, okay. So I want to do this quickly. I would define it, those are items that you could disagree on and still be within the pale of classical Christianity. There are some things that you disagree on and you say that disqualifies you from Christianity. There aren't that many of those things, but those are the kinds of things that are hills to die on, so to speak. The other ones are secondary issues, are issues that we disagree with on theologically, but in holding that view, one doesn't disqualify himself from being within the pale of classical Christianity.
Great, great.
Okay. So if you take exception with the resurrection or the blood atonement or the the deity of Christ or the two natures of Christ or the existence of God or the fallenness of man, those are central. Okay. If you disagree about baptism or whether you're dipped, sprinkled, or spit on, that kind of thing, well then that's secondary.
Okay. What about the example at hand is let's say gender roles.
Yeah. Well, gender roles are not essential; they're secondary.
Okay. Great. That's what I thought. Okay.
Right.
So. The second question would be, how does one address and what responsibility do church leaders have in teaching their views on these secondary doctrines?
Well, I think the churches have a responsibility to teach their views because the Bible is thick with secondary doctrines. It doesn't mean that they're not important or they're not significant to productive Christian living, but it does mean that it doesn't mean they're not significant to Christian living. It just means that they're not essential for being a Christian. So the bulk of the things that we probably talk about as Christians maybe fall in that secondary category. If the Scripture speaks to these things, then pastors ought to speak to them as they're teaching through the Scriptures. I think the weight that is given to them ought to be the weight of their significance or importance in the larger picture. For example, it might be that gender roles at certain times in culture are not a big deal, but other times in culture they become a big deal because they become a pivot point upon which the whole gospel rests in a certain sense. So it might be politically correct to be feminist now. Now that becomes an issue against the whole gospel, not just a discussion about gender, within the church.
Right.
So sometimes these things rise to more weighty concerns in the culture than at other times.
Yeah. Okay, because this is where the crux of my question and concern comes in.
All right.
If strictly speaking, if preachers, like expository preaching, you'll pick a book, you'll go through the book, and you kind of address whatever topics that happen to lie within those passages. But today, it seems like the influence and the sway of some issues, like they outfrequent the actual physical number of you know.
Verses that are speaking to.
Verses that
no,
to
I, those right. I'm with you on this. I do right. think there are times when these issues, certain issues. Well, look at abortion. I mean, the Bible doesn't speak a lot about abortion, obviously. It has principles and statements that one can apply to the question. But when there are periods of time when abortions aren't happening, then those issues aren't discussed. But when you have an issue where abortions are pushed, then, you know, and lots of them are happening, well, then it becomes more of an issue. And I don't know if your thing here is gender roles and whether that should be made more of an issue of. I don't know if that's it, but I certainly agree with your point broadly.
Well, I guess the way that my church's approach to it is like they're not going to divide the body over these secondary issues, and that somewhat translates into we're not going to like publicly address the controversy in it.
Well, yes, like, but the question, okay, why is it? Like, and again, I'm looking at the clock, so I'm going quickly. Why is it that? That talking about a controversial issue is dividing the body. I want you to think about the role of a pastor. A pastor is a shepherd, and the shepherd is to guide the sheep, all right? It is his job to guide the sheep. Now, if the sheep don't want to follow, then they shouldn't follow, all right? But if a pastor is going to say, I'm not going to talk about anything that could be controversial and people would disagree with me on, and therefore, quote-unquote, divide the church, well, then he's not leading the sheep, is he? They're just milling around, talking about things everybody agrees on. Now, I think sometimes you can get into, you know, nitpicky controversies that just aren't worth the trouble. But other things are, and maybe there's going to be a difference of opinion on this. But I am suspicious of pastors who simply say, look, you know, the church is going to divide on this. Well, if the church is going to divide on this, if it's that big of a deal that your church is going to divide on it, well, then maybe it is the thing to talk about.
Like, let's say, just for this, you know, I know we're looking at the clock. Maybe you can address this, maybe not, and I can hang up. But if let's say that the leadership, like the core of the group, the elders, you know, say their position is, you know, for example, women should not preach at the pulpit. Now, they may all have their stake in the ground believing that, but they're not specifically going to, like, publicly address it?
Okay, let me tell you something, Andy. This particular issue, they cannot avoid this because they have a pulpit and they have gifted people that God has given to speak in that pulpit. They have got to make a decision on this. This is not something that can be avoided. This is like requirements for eldership. Well, we're just not going to deal with that. That's a secondary issue. Wait a minute. Do you have elders? If you have elders, then you have to look at the requirements for elders. And if you don't have elders, why not? So there are some things that are fixtures in ecclesiastical structure. I almost had elastical, and that's part of the problem, right? Too much elasticity in this. Things that are fixtures in church structure, biblically speaking, have to be addressed. They can't be denied. And if people don't like what God's Word says about governance in the local church, they should go somewhere else. I don't know what else to say. Well, that's it for this hour. 2 hours ahead, please stay with us on Stand to Reason.
Ideas, and his personal hygiene is above reproach.
Absolutely impeccable. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, that's the show. I'm the host. Glad you joined me. Thank you for tuning in. I always appreciate my listeners and my callers, too. Lines open at 1-800-227-5278. Actually, they may all be full right now, but stay with us and we'll talk with you about anything on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. And I welcome all the new listeners climbing on board from all over the country, American Family Radio Network. And you're welcome to participate in the discussion, too. I heard something a little earlier today that I've heard many times in the past, and it's almost what I would call a pastorism. It's a slogan that's used. And something about this slogan, a slogan that's used that is meant to communicate a spiritual truth, but it does so in a way that is an imbalanced way and then also communicates something that's false. That's what I mean by a pastorism. And there are lots of these. God loves the sinner, but he hates the sin is an example of one. God turned his back on Jesus and the cross is another one. And there are things like this. I mean, there's something in there that's, you know, you can grab on that's right, but there's also something that's misleading. And the one that I heard just this morning is that comes from a student of a Christian professor. And in the class, the professor made the comment that all sin is sin. And this was in response to a statement that suggested that some sins were worse than others. And the professor just simply said, look, sin is sin. And that's a pastorism because it's true that sin is sin. It's hard to argue with. It's a tautology. A equals A. And I think that beyond that, there is the sense that every sin, even the most minor sin, is egregious in God's sight and enough to disqualify somebody from salvation, which is why James says in James 2:10, I believe, or yeah, 2:10, I think, that if you break one of the points of the law, you're guilty of the whole thing. And then he gives the illustration of what he means. If you commit murder but don't commit adultery, you're guilty under the law. But if you commit adultery but don't commit murder, you're still guilty under the law. Either way, you're guilty under the law. You've broken the law, you're guilty. And I think that's James's point. It certainly is not the point he's making, I think, there, that there are no sins that are any more egregious than any other sins, which was the application the professor was making. And I know that James couldn't be making that point, because if he did, he'd be contradicting his brother, or I should say his half-brother, who is Jesus of Nazareth, because Jesus said the opposite. And Jesus just said in a very straightforward way, actually there are two places where he made comments along this line, both at the end of his ministry, but the one that stands out for me most vividly is when Jesus is before Pilate, I think it's Pilate, and maybe Herod, but it's during the night of his trial, and he says, "The person who delivered me up to you has the greater sin." Now, I think he's probably referring to the high priest at that point. But in any event, what matters here is Jesus' identification of one sin as greater than the other. And this citation alone should be enough to end the debate from Scripture, from Revelation, that some sins, that no sin is greater than another sin. Jesus says quite the contrary. There are greater sins. That's the word he uses. Actually, if you go back to chapter 23 of Matthew, this is maybe a few days before this event, towards the end, right near Passion Week, and Jesus is excoriating the Jewish leadership for their displays of piety before people, yet down inside they are like dead man's rotting bones. And this is where he delivers the series of woes. And one of those, he identified the habit of tithing mint, dill, and cumin. In other words, being so strict in their observance of the law that they even took those things you cook with, those and dividing those things up and tithing those little thing, herbs. I had a different seasonings or something. Right. Okay, there you go. Those are the hard words for me. Dividing up your seasoning, so they kind of kept the law and giving one-tenth of that, but then they ignore, and here was his words, the weightier provisions of the law, the things that matter more. So if you have lesser provisions and greater provisions of the law, of course you're obliged to keep both of them. But if you disregard the greater provisions, it seems straightforward that you're guilty of a greater sin. Now, this just I'm giving you the scripture verses first so you can see that the scripture teaches that there are greater sins than other sins. But something occurred to me as I was thinking about this. that maybe indicates there's something else that's going on when people say, well, all sin is sin. What if I said to somebody like that, maybe under a different set of circumstances, so they're not inclined to, say, defend turf, maybe I would say to them, you know, somebody got 10 years for petty larceny or something like that, the same as maybe a murderer got. And they were talking about how that's unjust because this person committed a lesser crime and the other got a greater crime, but they got the same punishment. And I said, well, you know, all crime is crime. All crime is crime. Now, if I said that in that conversation, insinuating the idea that there are no crimes that are any greater than any other crime, and if there are no crimes greater than any crime, then all the crimes should get the same punishment. I promise you that person would look at me like I was an idiot. If I said, well, all crimes are crimes, so you steal a candy bar, you kill somebody, you know, life imprisonment, what's the beef? That person would say, are you crazy? Are you out of your mind? What's up with that? They would, in other words, in any other circumstances where issues of justice were at stake, it would be easy for people to discern the difference between crimes and understand that different punishments are appropriate for different crimes. The legal concept is called lex talionis, or the law of the claw from the Latin, and it's referring here to an Old Testament principle, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Principle there being greatly misunderstood because of Jesus' comments about that in the Sermon on the Mount, the abuse of this notion. This is actually a principle of justice that the punishment should fit the crime. Now, if all crimes are the same, then the punishment will be the same for everybody. You don't need the law of the claw, lex talionis, an eye for an eye. Every crime is the same. Everybody gets the exact same punishment. But in the Old Testament law, that wasn't the case because every crime wasn't the same. So what I'm saying is just there's a common sense notion, isn't there? When you just reflect about your moral intuitions that what is appropriate and just in one circumstance isn't appropriate and just in another. So why would anybody be inclined to think that in somehow in God's assessment of things – it's going to be any different? Why wouldn't it comport with our own moral intuitions about these things, and even as displayed in the Old Testament law? And I'll tell you what I thought earlier today when I was thinking about this. This is what crossed my mind, is that this is an indication of this faith reason kind of divide. You know, a lot of Christians think that faith and reason are opposites. They're at opposite ends of the spectrum. That you have reason that you use to get knowledge, and that's over here. And on the other side, the things that you don't have good reasons for and therefore get knowledge from, the other side, that's the leap of faith stuff. And we Christians, we're about faith stuff. We're about just kind of leaping in the dark and believing ridiculous things, about religious wishful thinking, because this is all that we have available to us. Because if we go about using reason and are thoughtful about it, well, that's that other stuff that God doesn't want. Now, when I put it that way, I think many of you would see, well, that seems a little extreme. That's not quite right. Although many, not so much my listeners, but many others in the Christian world are going to nod their head. Yeah, that's what it's all about. These are the kind of people who say, well, look, if you've got all this evidence for it, then where is room for faith? And so they see faith and reason as opposites, and the relationship might be considered the relationship of divorce. These are two entities divorced from each other, one on either side. And I got this metaphor from David Horner and his wonderful book, Mind Your Faith, which I discussed on a panel with David Horner and Sean McDowell and Craig Hazen and some others, Phil Reichen from Wheaton College, you know, in a panel discussing this book, which I read last week, and it's a wonderful book by InterVarsity Press. And Dave, among other things, in his book Mind Your Faith, deals with this faith-reason divide in really a great way. And he says it's not divorce, it should be marriage. That is, two partners working together. And I'll tell you more about that in just a moment. But I got to thinking about this with the crime, all sin is sin kind of thing, because if we simply sat down and thought about it for a moment, let's just set the Bible aside for just a second. I gave you a biblical case why all sin is sin statements are really mistaken, if what you mean by that is that no sin is worse than the other because Jesus says otherwise. But can't we just take counsel from our own moral intuitions on this one? Can't we just say, you know, that doesn't make sense? Who would believe such a thing? We wouldn't accept such a thing in our own criminal system. Why should we accept it from God? That doesn't make any sense at all. So, and I think the impulse is that some people have this idea that we can't do that when it comes to Christianity, that we can't just think about it. We can't just ask ourselves the question, does that make sense? Because we're people who believe things that don't make sense. We're people who believe things that are just weird, that are just stupid, that are just foolish, that are silly, but we believe them anyway because we are fools for Christ. Incidentally, that phrase, fools for Christ, in 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians possibly, Paul was talking sarcastically, all right? The gospel is foolishness to those who are perishing. It isn't foolish. It's foolish to the perishing. They can't figure it out. It doesn't make sense to them, but it doesn't mean it's foolish, all right? But some people have this notion, yeah, we're just believing foolish kinds of things. Well, this isn't the biblical view. And where in any other way place, we would never countenance such a thought. Well, all crime is crime, so everybody gets the death penalty. When it comes to spiritual things, people just think, well, this is all right. This is one of those spiritual things. I don't have to think about it. Sin is sin. All sin's the same. That doesn't make sense. This isn't about thinking about things that make sense. This is just about, you know, having religious faith or whatever. And so it's almost as if when it comes to these kinds of things, we would never countenance such a thing being thoughtful about it. But when it comes to religion, well, we can believe ridiculous things because of faith. Now, I'm not diminishing the possibility of odd things and unusual things like the Trinity or maybe moral quandaries. We don't understand God's perspective entirely. But in this particular case, there is no revelation who says this thing, that all sin is sin in that sense. And so it's fair to draw from our own reflection on this. And indeed, there is revelation to the contrary, so that helps. But I mentioned a few moments ago Dave Horner's fine book, Mind Your Faith. I hope many of you get it, because it is meant to do really what we're doing at Stand to Reason in terms of building ambassadors. There's a knowledge component. There's a kind of a wisdom component. There's a character component. And his book deals with almost exactly those three areas. That is the life of the mind, then faith, and how that relates, our spiritual convictions, and how it ties into the life of the mind, and then how it influences the kinds of human beings we are and the way we live, the virtue in our lives, in a great balance. But I was especially thankful for his treatment of the faith reason issue. And as I mentioned, his way of characterizing this in a very useful metaphor is thinking it not in terms of divorce, but in terms of marriage. Not as opposing parties going opposite directions, but really as partners in the same enterprise. And here's the way he put this, and it's one of the best ways that I've heard it put. And this is one reason I want to pass it on to you. And when you see it this way, you will see immediately that there is no conflict between faith and reason in the biblical worldview. And in fact, they go together. And before I give you this way of looking at it, I just want to note, as he does, that one of the biggest objections that the new atheists have brought against religion is that religious people have blind faith. They believe in things for which there is no evidence. But never, and there ergo the conflict between faith and reason, and they are people of reason, not people of blind faith. But it's curious that, as Dave points out, David Horner points out in his book, Mind Your Faith, that there is no definition of reason that is given in their pieces, that is the New Atheist. There is no definition of faith that is given such that one can compare the definition of reason to the definition of faith and see that there is a conflict between them. And in his book, he does both. He says, here's what reason is. Assessing, reasons for a point of view and logical relationships and those kinds of things, and see if there's adequate justification for a belief. But faith, he said, has actually, well, he says four components. I'll say three because I think the last two are very similar. First, there is an object. When you have faith, you have something or someone you have faith in. Secondly, there is content, and that is there are details about what it means to put your faith in that thing, like a chair. That's the object of your faith. The belief, the content is that the chair will hold you, your body weight. And the third thing is an act of trust or commitment, and that is there you go over and sit in the chair. So those are three elements of faith: object, content, and trust or commitment. I thought that was a pretty good characterization. Now, when you think about the definition of rationality and the definition of faith, where is the conflict? And the answer is there is none. If you zero in on what reason is and you zero in on what faith is, you realize that there's no conflict. And so here's the way he characterized it, and this was my takeaway and maybe your takeaway for the commentary at the beginning of this hour. That is, reason assesses, faith trusts. Reason assesses, faith trusts. So reason takes a look at something and assesses it, whether or not it is trustworthy, and then faith takes the thing, the object, and believes certain things true about the object, that's the content, and then acts in a trusting way regarding the object in light of the reasons. Not blind faith, but a reasonable step of trust. Anyway, it was a great distinction, and one I'm going to hang on to for a long time and tout as a great way of characterizing the relationship of faith and reason, not divorce, but marriage. Reason assesses, faith trusts, no conflict. The opposite of faith is not reason. The opposite of faith is unbelief, or lack of trust, if you will. The opposite of reason is not faith. The opposite of reason is irrationality. So it certainly is possible to have reasonable faith, and it is also possible to have unreasonable unbelief. I'm Greg Kokel. I'll be back with your calls on Stand to Reason after this.
Hi, Greg Kokel here, inviting you to a conference you won't soon forget. The location? The Eastern Caribbean. Join us as we set sail March 17, 2012, from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for 8 days aboard Holland America's MS Eurodam for an unforgettable trip to Grand Turks and Caicos Islands, San Juan, Puerto Rico, St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas. I'll be joined by Stand to Reason Student Impact Director Brett Kunkel and STR speaker and trainer Alan Schliemann for a lineup of conference sessions that will stimulate your thinking and equip you with practical skills. Everything about this trip is being planned with your enjoyment and enrichment in mind. And this year we're planning some special youth sessions led by Brett, so plan on bringing the family and enjoying great times of fellowship and spiritual deepening together. Not only will you be challenged with stimulating presentations, you'll have a chance to ask questions in open forum discussions and enjoy the interaction and fellowship with both our speakers and your fellow passengers on deck, sharing great meals together and ashore as we enjoy the splendor of the Eastern Caribbean's beautiful resort ports. So save the dates and contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours. That's 800-247-1899. They're assisting Stand to Reason with their trip, and their skilled staff is committed to answering all your questions and helping to make this a memorable experience. You can also visit our website at str.org for all the information. I hope to see you there in the Caribbean with Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. What do we do when our students doubt? What should be our response? And does Jesus have anything to say about doubt? Download my Bulletproof podcast this month to find out. Look for Bulletproof on iTunes or on the podcast page at str.org.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Greg's speaking events? What people are saying about STR resources? You can find STR on Facebook and follow STR on Twitter. Learn more about STR staff,
post comments, and get involved with other like-minded Christians. On Facebook, you'll find the official Stand to Reason page, a Solid Ground fan page, and the STR Place Facebook home for student outreach. You can find them all connected at our official page. And finally, follow STR on Twitter at STR Tweets, where you can also engage other listeners live during the radio program using the hashtag STR Talk.
Greg Kokel back with you here at Stand the Reason. And if I knew that the caller I have on next was going to be the next caller, I would have had some Bob Dylan played here. It's Francis J. Beck with Frank. It's a treat to take your call.
Greg.
Nice talking to you, buddy.
Yeah, you know, I just got my hair cut, jumped in my car, and heard you talking. And the part that I caught, and it turned out most of what you were saying had to do with the faith reason question in Horner's book. But which actually I saw yesterday in the bookstore, and it does look like a terrific read.
Right. It is.
The thing you were talking about, the differences in sin, something that I actually was sharing with my students at Baylor a couple of weeks ago. I'm teaching a graduate, an undergraduate course called Faith, Reason, and Christian Belief. And one of the things that I pointed out was, you know, when Paul turns that one guy over to the devil.
Yeah, First Corinthians 5, right.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 5. So what happened? Hey, you know, if all sin were sin, then he would have to do that to the guy that was, let's say, rude.
That's right.
Right, you know, because, you know, being rude is a sin, right?
Sure.
I mean, you're not treating people with dignity and respect, or like somebody who tells a white lie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's clear that there's something a lot more serious in sleeping with your stepmom than it is telling a white lie.
Yeah, and of course that's the sin here in 1 Corinthians 5. But tell me, why is it these kinds of responses, on the one hand I understand them because there's a handy little slogan, that the kind of thing that I identified as pastorism, something that is kind of true in a way. All sin is lethal, but so all sin is sin, you know, and that's the James chapter 2 passage, I think, verse 10. But then when it comes down to, you know, when the way people, excuse me, treat it is that, well, then no sin is better than the other. It's just so obviously false to me. I'm wondering why people say these kinds of things when they ought to know better. And that's why I kind of invoke this faith-reason dichotomy here as possibly something that's explanatory in this case. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, I think it may have something. This is more of and I'm certainly not an historian, but you know, I think it may have to do with kind of how American Christianity is, because I don't think you find much of this in Europe or in the global South. I think it's because we come out of this kind of revivalist tradition, the second great awakening, and this whole idea of you know, sort of the, you know, coming to Christ no matter where you're at, which is, of course, something I don't oppose, but I think this sense, this kind of egalitarianism, which is built into it, and I think it may very well come out in the way we look at something like sin. It doesn't matter whether your sin is very little or very big, you're in rebellion against God and you have to come to the cross.
Well, of course, that point is true. I mean, as far as it goes, and that's, in a sense, the true side or the true half of the pastorism. But then this is what I have trouble with these kinds of aphorisms, because they do a little bit of work. It's kind of like God turned his back on Jesus on the cross. Well, you know, he didn't have a back to turn, you know, but I understand there's a judgment there, and so you get that. Yeah. But then out of this grows these kind of goofy things about Jesus going to hell and separated from the Father, and the word faith stuff that is kind of grounded in the same pastorism. And so they've got an ugly side to them, and this is the case here, I think.
Well, you may be tapping into something, too, is this sort of reveling in irrationality that you get among some Christians.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, it does seem absurd that, you know, stealing gum from 7-Eleven is the same as the Holocaust, but that's all religion.
Yeah. That's right.
You know, I mean, there is that kind of, I mean, I don't know if, you know, that, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into the way people think about this stuff.
No, I do think some people do. I made a reference to the Fools for Christ verse in Corinthians where Paul, I think, was clearly, when you look at the context, speaking sarcastically, you know, with regards to how people, we're the fools, or you're the fools, or Christianity is foolish. Well, maybe foolish to the perishing, but it isn't. It's God's wisdom in it. But some people pick up on that in isolation, and they think we've got to be idiots, and that's somehow spiritually desirable.
I think that's the right take on this. What you were talking about Horner's book, I think it's, you know, one thing that I think a lot of folks underestimate, and you and I have seen this at the kids at Summit, and I've seen this with my students at Baylor, is that once you expose them to thinking about these issues,
mm-hmm.
there's a sense of liberation that kicks in.
Yeah.
That is, all of a sudden they can think about these things.
Yeah, that's right.
And what I do, I'm teaching this course I mentioned earlier. I have them read, actually, J.P. Moreland and Gary Dewey's little book on philosophy made a little more simple.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And Kelly Clark's book, Return to Reason, and Ralph McInerney's Introduction to Thomas Aquinas, A Guide for Peeping Thomas.
Uh-huh.
And that's what the title of. And what it is what I show them is like three different ways in which Christians have thought about these issues.
Mm-hmm.
The Reform way, you know, JP's way, and
mm-hmm.
McInerney.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does, it kind of shows them that Christians are in conversation over this, but it's
mm-hmm.
not over the question of whether we can reason about it.
Yeah, you know, this. I made an observation once, and who is the Jesuit who wrote the history of philosophy, those multi-volume sets?
Paul Copleston.
Right, Frederick Copleston. And I actually owned that series at one point. Then I gave it to the enforcer because I knew I was never going to read it. But I just made an observation there because he goes back to the ancients, of course, and then works forward. But from the time of Christ, after about the first 100 years, virtually every single person in the history of Christian thought that made a contribution in the world of philosophy up to maybe the 18th century was a Bible believing Christian theist.
Yeah,
it was unbelievable. I mean, you got 1800 years of thoughtful contribution about the largest questions imaginable. So for Christians to think or to be tempted to think that this is somehow outside of our tradition shows how myopic historically they actually are.
Oh yeah, yeah. It is remarkable. You go back. One of the questions I raised actually in class the other day to my students, because we're going to go over the problem of evil.
Mm-hmm.
I asked them, why is it that up until the Enlightenment, even though clearly Christians knew about evil,
mm-hmm.
they knew it existed, but they never thought the problem of evil defeated theism.
Mm-hmm.
They always thought of it as how do we account for this? How do we make sense of it?
Right.
And I think it has to do with the fact that we've kind of, after the 18th century, kind of abandoned the idea that we start with what we believe
mm-hmm.
and try to look at the world that way. We've accepted the presuppositions of the new atheist,
in other words. Yeah, this reminds me now of the Augustinian and maybe Anselm repeated something like this, faith-seeking understanding.
That's right.
The willingness to take our understanding of spiritual things based on authority and then to work from there to apply reason and things to them to get a deeper understanding, given that they saw the legitimacy of the authority to begin with, the Bible. So this isn't just a leap of faith and then trying to patch reason in, but it's understanding that there are authorities that speak authoritatively about spiritual things and then working from there.
It's what I like to tell this my students. It's organic.
Mm-hmm.
That if you think of sort of your sort of individual spiritual journey as sort of, you're like an organism.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you are an organism, right? And you assimilate things and you grow and develop over time. And
mm-hmm.
after a while, you are sure of certain things and more, you know, less sure of others as a consequence. And there's almost a symbiotic thing going on. So it isn't like, you know, sort of begin with, we don't start like Descartes.
Mm-hmm.
We don't start with doubt.
Correct. Well, there's no reason to, although this is kind of the modern method, is to start with doubt. This is where everybody seems to start, and then they don't seem to get out of that in many cases. But let's just take, and I'm talking with Francis Beckwith here, who just happened to call in because he's listening to the show in Waco. And you're probably listening on AM 1010 KBW.
Absolutely.
Yeah, great. Well, they're one of our first stations to come on board after KBRT. But you mentioned about the problem of evil being kind of an internal problem, not an external problem. And this is something that I'm not sure that people actually get, though it is really a part of the conclusion of our book on relativism, the moral argument for the existence of God. That there is evil in the world is only coherent if there is some means of testing or assessing good and evil, some transcendent standard of goodness, some scoring system, and it's going to be very difficult to ground that scoring system, the objective transcendent scoring system, if you don't have God. God is the best grounding. I think he's the only grounding for it. So you can hardly use the problem of evil as an argument against God when there has to be God existing for there to be a problem of evil to begin with.
And that's right. In fact, if you're an atheist, one of my students actually made this point the other day in class. It was real clever. He said, wait a second, if I'm an atheist, there's still a problem of evil.
Right.
You know, he just said,
absolutely.
It's like there's still evil in the world. In fact, it makes less sense.
Exactly right. I was just going to follow up with this thought, but this is a perfect segue to it.
Yeah.
When I speak to groups now, even on campus, hostile groups, hostile in terms of ideas, I haven't run into a genuinely hostile group in a long time, but obviously they don't share ideas, and I talk about the problem of evil, which is a big issue. I tell them that I am not addressing this problem now as a philosopher, as a theologian. I address the problem of evil as a human being trying to make sense out of my world. That is, I encounter something that is real in the world, and that is evil, and I have to try to figure out what point of view has the best explanatory power, to put it in scientific terms. And so, therefore, and this is how I set my whole presentation up, Frank, I'm saying, therefore, if you are an atheist out there who has rejected God because of the problem of evil, you need to know that you have not escaped the problem. You have just put yourself into a worldview that has fewer resources to make sense of the problem of evil. In fact, I think has no resources to make sense of it. And if you're going to be consistent as a materialist, you're going to have to reject the moral categories outright as inconsistent with materialism and say that the problem of evil and good and the presence of good are just illusions possibly created by Darwinian evolution. But they're illusions nonetheless. They tell us nothing about the world as it is in itself. And that's what you're stuck with. And if that sounds more appealing to you, then you're welcome to it. But it does. That seems to be much more counterintuitive to me.
That's right. And this is where, you know, I think kind of faith comes in. And in this sense, you have this, you say, have really good evidence for God's existence. You believe the story of Jesus and his resurrection is true. And yet there seems to be a lot of evil in the world. Well, this is when I think we put our faith in providence. This is something Aquinas actually says when dealing with the problem of evil. He says, you can't isolate particular evil from the big picture in the sense that that God sees the whole thing at once. But if you, in fact, have very good reason to believe in God and very good reason to believe in the incarnation, the resurrection, then, in fact, this is the point at which we have hope.
Yes, There's something redemptive. In our story, there is hope for redemption. It's like the famous quote by the British atheist Bertrand Russell, how can you talk about God when you're kneeling at the foot of the bed of a dying child? And I actually heard this first from Bill Craig and William Lane Craig, and he offered his own reflection on this. I don't know if you heard this, Frank, but he says, what is the atheist Bertrand Russell going to say when he's kneeling at the bed of a dying child? Tough luck, you know, that's the way it goes. There's nothing there for him, and it shows the inadequacy of the worldview to meet the task, where the theist has something they can draw on, not only to make coherent the problem of evil, because it's entailed in our story. It's not an intruder, it's part of our story. But there's also a solution to this. There's a resolution down the line to this problem.
Yeah.
Let me ask, since I have you on the air here, then we're talking about this issue. You brought up a point that I actually traded on last hour with a caller, and I want to run his objection past you because I think it's an objection that that resonates with me. I mean, I have to say, well, look, you know, I understand what you're saying here, and this is something I've thought about too, as a concern, and I, frankly, I don't know how to answer the question proper, but what I do is I fall back on these other issues. I have, you have to understand this in terms of worldview. I have evidence for my worldview and the goodness of God and all these other things, and so I'm stuck with these outliers that I can't make the best sense of. And this has to do with the issue of, well, he brought up the question of why did God allow Satan to deceive people when God knew that in the deception, his children would fall and then go to hell forever, and so this seems like an immoral God. And but it really does come down to the core issue, and this was brought up, that given the fact that human beings are fallen, and God knew that Adam and Eve would sin, and this would result in a fallen race, which fallen race would be under condemnation by nature until rescued by Jesus. How could God morally justify such a thing when people are born into sin but still held responsible for sin? And I actually think that that is an imponderable, and maybe you've done some reflection on this. I don't know how Thomas deals with it, but how would you have responded to that?
It's the question of original sin.
Yes, exactly.
A couple of ways to respond. One, and this is sort of the first response is sort of the bite the bullet response, and that is, you know, you're looking at original sin, like this is, I'm responding to the guy who called. You're looking at it as if it's you're being that it's in fact somehow unjust for God to have allowed Adam's sin to be passed on, in the sense that he knows that if you didn't have original sin, then you wouldn't have sinned as well. And here I'm going to sort of use a kind of middle knowledge response, that in a sense, in Adam, we all were. That is to say, every one of us put in that exact position would have done exactly the same thing. And in that sense, if you want to sort of, this is, if you want a kind of autonomy justification for it,
it wouldn't have changed any. You're saying had everybody been autonomous, the end result would have still been the same.
That's right. Imagine the principle here. He's saying it's unfair to be to receive condemnation or because of something you did not do. Okay,
that's right. Or you couldn't have prevented, or you couldn't have helped the way you were born.
That's right. And so the question then is, Is it possible that God knew that in every possible world, any one of us put in that position would have done it? If, in fact, that's possible, then it's not unjust for us to have received Adam.
Basically, that's arguing that the end would have been the end result would have been the same anyway, so it doesn't matter. But let me push back a little bit. Here's my concern about that is, but that isn't what we were facing. What we are, in fact, facing is a circumstance in which we are actually injured by somebody else's sin, and that is the thing itself that organically dictates our own fallenness. And so it isn't that, you know, that counterfactual that you just cited, but it is the actual circumstance here of fallenness through Adam. So,
another way to look at it is, and I think maybe the reason why this issue, interesting enough, you never find this objection prior to the Enlightenment. And I think the reason is that the rugged, radical individualism that dominates our world today was not even on the radar back then in the Middle Ages or any. And so there was a sense in which we're all in this together.
Right.
That the human beings are interconnected in a deeply intimate way, and that because we're social beings, sin by its very nature can't be merely individual. It's just the nature of the way that God made us.
Well, and it's the federal. This maybe ties into the concept of the federal headship of Adam. It's like he sinned for us, and so like when the president declares war on another country, the whole country is at war, even people who don't like the idea, but we're still fighting the battle, and we're still vulnerable to those things because he stands in for us.
None of us asked. I mean, there's a tremendous vulnerability in being human. That is to say, every one of us are the product of two people who we did not choose to be our parents. So, I mean, even from the very beginning, nothing is up to us.
Yeah.
And I do think about it. I've been, you know, one of the things that's interesting to go back and read, I've been going back and reading some of the Augustine and even his interaction with Pelagius, which is fascinating.
Which is really somewhat akin to the discussion we're having right now.
And if you go back to read the Council of Orange's canons on Pelagius, one of the things they talk about is how the sin of Adam does have this obvious effect. And this is the way Augustine looked at it. This is what the text says.
Mm-hmm.
I have to believe it.
Mm-hmm.
But God gave a redeemer, a second Adam,
mm-hmm.
so that we in fact can be redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
And this is part of it. And it's a story, I think it's very difficult for the modern mind to handle it, not because it's irrational. It's because it doesn't fit what we think human beings ought to be.
Yeah, it's not fair.
And that's the reality, is that God made us this way. And this is something that also goes against the grain of the modern world.
Mm-hmm.
It's that at some point, you have to throw yourself at the foot of the cross and say, I can't do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that goes against autonomy,
right.
Self-determination,
mm-hmm.
and this ticks people off.
Yeah. Yep, there's all those things are mixed in there. So anyway, I got to run to break here, Frank. It's
okay.
A real treat talking to you. I presume I'll see you in a few days at ETS in San Francisco.
I will be there, and they put me in a session with Bill Craig and Mike Lacana.
Oh, great!
So apparently they're
very interesting.
Big room. So.
Well, I'll probably be in the gallery there, Frank.
Well, I'm going to be delivering a paper on same-sex marriage and liberalism.
Uh-huh. Okay, good.
So, which is nothing to do with what we're talking about now.
No, and I probably won't be in that session, but the one with Bill Craig and Mike Lacona I probably will be in, because that's quite a controversy right now. In any event, Frank, thank you for calling in. It's good to have you as a listener, as a friend, and I look forward to seeing you next week.
See you then. Keep it up, man. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. All the best. Francis J. Beckwith calling in on the spur of the moment, driving back from his haircut in Waco, Texas. I got to go to break here. I'll be back with more of your calls in just a moment. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material too by using the brand new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800-2-REASON.
My name is Alan Schliemann, but recently I was introduced as Saeed Ibn Umar to a group of Christians who thought I was a real Muslim. During my role play, I fired off the most common Islamic arguments to see if they were prepared to answer the Muslim challenge. Find out how they did in this month's podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Look for
now
it
you
on
can
iTunes
take STR with you through the
page
new
at str.org.
Now you can take STR with you through the new apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad, available for free from iTunes or the Android market. You can listen to STR podcasts, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letter, and much, much more. You can also follow STR on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed and created by the group that has created apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you'll be pleased with the clean layout, the great features and functionality of the STR apps. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new STR app by posting a review on iTunes or the Android market. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
That was a a nice treat having Frank Beckwith call in and to get his point of view on some of these issues. Really a good thinker on so many things. And glad to have him as a colleague and a friend. We mentioned Dave Horner's book, Mind Your Faith. Frank brought it up, and I'd been talking a little bit about it. And I just realized next weekend, on Sunday next, the 20th, my daughter Annabeth is going to be baptized. And so I will be there celebrating her baptism that day. And J. Warner Wallace will be filling in for me, which I'm sure a lot of you folks are glad to hear because you like him, from what I understand. And it's nice to have a break from me once in a while. And J. Warner makes a great contribution. He will actually be having a conversation with David Horner about his new book, Mind Your Faith, so you can look forward to that. Let's go to Dave in Sparks, Nevada. And Dave, you've been so faithful waiting online for us. Thank you for your patience.
Sure, no problem. I got a feeling I probably got bumped by Frank Beth.
Yeah, you actually did in that particular case.
I can't complain about that.
All right, good. Thank you for your understanding.
Hey, I'd like to say to start, I've been really blessed by your ministry. Looking at my past podcasts, I think I've probably been listening to you for a little over 2 years.
Uh-huh, thanks.
And really helped me kind of learn how to think. You know, I've always understood the importance of taking stuff in context and everything mm-hmm. else, but really getting into that careful thinking and careful mm-hmm. analysis, it's been great.
Well, good. Thanks. Yeah.
And I like to encourage people out there. I think last year I ended up finally making a donation to you guys.
Really makes me happy.
Oh, good. Yeah, the other ministries that I used to listen to when I first became a Christian and all that, you kind of take now what they used to get.
Well, I appreciate your kindness to us, and maybe this is a good point to mention to the rest of the listeners. We're moving into the end of the year, and this is our biggest month, December, you know, where it makes or breaks us for the year, and a lot of folks have been listening to the show for a long time like you have and never really thought of helping out, and this is a great time for you to send in a gift if you like to stand a reason. You can do it at str.org very easily. It's a way of saying thanks for us being here and helps us to continue to be here in the future. So some of you might want to think of a Christmas gift to STR. And thank you, Dave, for that. What's on your mind now?
My question today is actually, you know, you mentioned J. Warner Wallace. I have a lot in common with him. I've been in law enforcement for a while, and mm-hmm. I came to faith later on in life. And but anyway, it with a law enforcement background, you know, even as a younger officer, before I was a Christian, and even since I became a Christian, it's always been clear in my mind about the issue of using force or violence mm-hmm. and the issue of whether the death penalty is okay and things like that. So I'm okay on that.
Right.
But I got thinking, you know, when Osama bin Laden was killed, there was a lot of chatter with Christian friends on Facebook about basically the appropriateness of the Christian response.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those where, it's fine because he's, you know, now that he's dead, I guess for self-preservation, he can't hurt us anymore, you know, for protection.
Yeah.
But then you get kind of the, I don't know if it's the visceral reaction of, he's our enemy and he's an evil man and he's dead.
Uh-huh.
And should we be happy about that? Because I look back at, you know, you can look at the example of Paul, of course. He was an enemy of Christendom for a while.
Yeah.
And even more modern examples, you see or you hear stories of people who were members of Hamas and things like
uh-huh.
that, and now they become Christians.
Sure.
I know God doesn't want anyone to perish and things like that. But, you know, I still go, I go back to, it's almost like I can't help but be happy that he's dead.
Well, I'm with you on this one. And to be honest, I was a bit surprised by this issue coming up.
Yeah.
And because, look, we're fighting a war, and in the war that we're fighting, and not just this one, but wars in the past, and we think of a victory that we have sustained by defeating the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, defeating the enemy means killing him. I mean, there's no other way around it, or at least killing a lot of them. And so is this it just seems to me that most people have not raised this issue with regards to that. It isn't like this is a consistent issue that comes up in Christian circles and like, we should not be, you know, excited about or celebrating our victories. But now, all of a sudden, with Osama bin Laden, it's like all of us, we're somehow high and mighty spiritual about this, and it surprised me a little bit. So there's a question of consistency.
Yeah, there was almost a lot of naivete, I think, especially from some of the younger people's comments that I saw. And
right.
A couple of the girls of, oh, you know, if we could have just talked to them and things like that. I didn't post it, but my response kind of was, well, girls, if you could have talked to them, you know, you probably would have been raped and murdered.
Yeah.
You have to look at the person that we're dealing with.
Yeah, right. And so I don't know, you know, as far as that particular issue is concerned, but I do think that there's a certain kind of naivete that is expressed in these kinds of things. And so and I want to be cognizant of the issue in a certain sense on the other side. I mean, there are biblical passages that talk about not rejoicing when our enemy falls,
right.
Loving our enemy and blessing rather than cursing, and those kinds of things. And so I don't mean to dismiss that and diminish that, but that is not the only thing the Bible happens to say about these things. When you have a mortal enemy who is living a deeply ungodly life and is deceiving many and is taking the lives of many people, why would we not rejoice when such an evil man is no more? And in this regard, I want to go back to something that I saw during the time after Osama, just soon after Osama bin Laden had been killed, and then there was this controversy that came to light. I just happened to be reading in the book of Revelation, and I noticed in chapter 19 and verse 20, and then I'm going to jump down into I'll make that chapter 18 and verse 20, then I'm going to jump down to the beginning of 19. It's talking in chapter 18 about the fall of the great city Babylon. All right.
Okay.
And of course, there is tremendous bloodshed at the fall of this evil city. This isn't a metaphor for just some spiritualized thing being done away with. This is part of the carnage of the book of Revelation.
Mm-hmm.
And verse 20 says, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints, apostles, and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you against her." So there is a command to rejoice that this evil thing, this evil system, you know, which inherently involves the evil people that are part of it, has been destroyed. It is an occasion for rejoicing. And then I want to skip down to the beginning of chapter 19 and just read a bit here. "After these things, I heard, as it were, a loud voice of a great multitude in heaven." So these are the saints in heaven, or the angels possibly, the multitude. "Hallelujah! Salvation and glory and power belong to our Lord, because his judgments," which he has just executed against Babylon, "are true and righteous. For he has judged the great harlot who was corrupting the earth with her immorality. He has avenged the blood of his bondservants on her." And a second time they said, "Hallelujah! Her smoke arises forever and ever." And the 24 elders and the four living creatures fell down and worshiped God who sits in the throne, saying, "Amen, hallelujah." And a voice came from the throne saying, "Give praise to our God, all of all you his bondservants, you who fear him, the small and the great." And on it goes, by the way, there's more.
Yeah.
Now that is rejoicing by the saints because of the fall of the and judgment, the death and destruction of the great harlot of Babylon. And this, of course, when you read the account, you realize that there are people that are involved in here. Now, why is there all this rejoicing that's commanded? Because the evil thing has been destroyed. The evil one has fallen. And some might say, yeah, well, God did that, not American military. Well, that misses the point.
Right.
Their point is you shouldn't be rejoicing over the death of the evil one. It isn't based on who kills him. It's rejoicing over the death. And here you have a massive section in the book of Revelation which commands rejoicing over the death of the evil one. So I don't want to remove the element about, you know, that we mentioned earlier about being merciful to your enemies and those kinds of things that Jesus said. But those kinds of things cannot obviate or make impossible the role of rejoicing when an evil person is no more. By the way, this reminds me of something that Dave Horner said the other day as a joke. He said the prison warden addressing the new prisoners, and he said to the new prisoners, "The world is a better place because you're here." So that's true, right? When justice is done, the world is a better place, and we can rejoice in that. Dave, thank you so much for your call. And Hour number three just ahead, our final hour of today. I look forward to talking to you here in Stand to Reason. Stay with us. Here on Stand to Reason, Greg Kokel, your host, and looking forward to talking with you. In fact, I'm going to go pretty much directly to the calls here. A lot of folks have been on for a while, and I've been talking a lot. So let's just do that. Let's go to Ed in Pennsylvania. And Ed, thank you for your patience here on Stand to Reason. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Greg. Well, first of all, real quick, since you were talking about the biblical definition of faith, it reminded me of my favorite analogy, which I still seem to like better than marriage analogy, and that's of an extension ladder, where the lower level is knowledge and has to be properly grounded for it to work. And then the upper, the extension part, is faith, and it only works if it's connected to the knowledge and going in the same direction.
That's very nicely done. And you think about it, you're climbing the ladder, you start at knowledge and you move then to, and wherever the ladder's going is where you're going to get your work done, right? If you're going out to paint or fix the roof or whatever, but you can't get there unless you've got the solid foundation. That's well done.
Yeah, nice. And if you try to use the faith by itself, you could get hurt.
Yeah, that's right. I usually kind of default to this illustration about taking a flight, and that is reason and knowledge information that allows me to believe that an airplane can get me to my destination, but I don't exercise trust, which is biblical faith, in the airplane until I get on it.
Right.
And then you can see there's a very different thing. That's a very different thing than knowing the airplane is capable of it. You're actually entrusting yourself to it and you get on it. So,
right.
All right.
So, anyway, I was calling about determinism. You had talked about that a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think you touched on it a little bit at the beginning of the show, in the first hour.
Yeah.
And when I was listening to it, you were describing it as, you know, when you were talking with somebody, that it wasn't necessarily determinism that you were doing that. And as a computer programmer, I can kind of see maybe some of the deterministic guys going, you know, crying foul over that that description.
Right, what was my characterization you're going to take exception with, just so everybody's on board, me too, including
what
me?
What you were saying was that that you were taking the guy's call. I don't remember his name, and if I try to guess him, I'll probably get it wrong.
Right. Uh-huh.
And you were saying it was a decision for you to take his call. It wasn't determined.
Correct. It was an agent causation, not event causation, which is kind of a crisp way of thinking about it, though it sounds a little highfalutin philosophical. It still does some good work there for us.
Right. And I think it's correct, but I can't help but think that some people might take exception with that.
Okay.
And as a programmer, I design systems where you might take a lot of complex inputs and produce an output based on those inputs.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, it may not look like the output is predetermined at the time of the input, but it's predictable.
Well, there's a difference between something being predetermined and being predictable, because predictability is an epistemological notion, that is the notion of how we know. If we can predict it, that means we know the chains of action and reaction that allows us to see the end from the beginning. But right. If we can't predict it, it doesn't mean it's not determined. It just means that we can't necessarily see those links. So a thing that is determined is determined, and determined things are maybe in principle predictable, but maybe not actually so in a given situation.
Well, when a end user is using the system I've designed, for instance, they don't know all the logic that goes on beneath the surface.
Right.
So they might see results maybe that they don't necessarily expect. But it's still I would still view that as deterministic.
Well, it would be, because the end necessarily follows from whatever actions you put in. I mean, you push the button, you have this software programming that necessarily results in a certain end. That's the point of programming.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so.
And I could see where, you know, some people might go, well, humans are just a more complex version of that.
Well, a lot of people do that. There's no question. That is their argument, or their assertion, I should say, that humans are just complex examples. But then it raises problems, and it's the problematic nature of that assertion that makes me think the assertion is false. So are you wanting me to respond to that claim?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I have my own thoughts on that claim, but I would like to see what
All
you
right.
have to say on it.
Well, if determinism is true, then what you have to picture is like a bunch of dominoes falling in complicated ways. These are all the physical interactions of things, and maybe they're so complex we can never anticipate or figure out what the complexity is, even obviously much more complex than your computer programming. But still, the nature of the causal relationship is still the same. It's one domino falling against another. And if you're a physicalist and that's the way things are explained, then these dominoes go all the way back to the Big Bang. And nothing more or less than the laws of physics and chemistry have strictly determined the order of those dominoes and how they will fall. What this means is that there could not, given the initial conditions, there could not have been any other combination of events than the events that we're experiencing right now. That's because in that system, there is nothing but dominoes, and we're going to call that event causation. But if you think about a domino chain, you know, dominoes are actually set up, it could be set up in certain configurations, so that if you flick one domino, all the rest of them fall mechanistically and might produce this, you know, a picture of the United States or something like that. So when we look at all the dominoes, we see a certain design there, plus we have the falling domino cascade initiated not by a domino, but by somebody flicking it, a person flicking it. Okay.
Right.
And so we have, at least in principle, another kind of causation. We have event causation, all the dominoes falling, but we have the agent that is setting the dominoes up in a certain order and then also flicking the domino. All right. Now, the question is, which one is the best description of the natural realm? Is it all dominoes falling, or are there agents that are not determined by other dominoes falling against them, but they can initiate events in causal chain of events, and they can stop the causal chain of events if they want? They're unique in that regard. They can start or stop causal chains. And if you're a physicalist, there is no room for agents. And so whatever looks like something has been designed, like the United States, that isn't a real design. That is just the way it turned out. And not only is there no real design, there are no real decisions, because even we are complex chains of dominoes. Now, the problem with that view is it certainly looks like things are designed for a purpose. Secondly, I have an awareness that I am the one initiating my own actions. Now, somebody might, so it feels like and seems like, as I reflect on my own internal states, that I'm making decisions as an agent. Now, somebody could say, well, that's all part of the illusion. Then I'm going to say, how do you know that it's part of the illusion? Because the only way they can know it's part of the illusion, that we're really all determined, even though it looks like we're making choices, is if they made some choices based on the evidence to conclude that we are all determined. So the process of coming to the knowledge that the world is really deterministic requires a certain level of freedom to even do that. And so the upshot is going to be, if the universe is determined, which is certainly may be the case, and maybe we're just sophisticated computers, like you said, that had no programmer, well, then we could never know it. We could believe determinism because we are determined to believe it. We could believe libertarian freedom because we were determined to believe that, but we can never come to rational conclusions that this is so because such a thing requires freedom. And so by the very nature of the thing, it seems to me the claim that you know that the universe is determined is self-contradictory. And for all of these reasons, which I think are all really good reasons, one based on incoherence and the other two based on simple observation of cause and effect and relationship, I think I'm justified in believing that I am a free agent and the universe is not determined. So that's how I would respond to the claim that we're just sophisticated computers.
Okay.
It doesn't seem that way. It seems like someone designed. A design takes purpose. Purpose takes a purposer. And even the process of thinking to come to the conclusion that we are probably determined itself is evidence against determinism.
Well, that makes my head spin a bit.
Well, I'm not surprised, but in one sense, it's a little bit more of a sophisticated argument. I think I talk about this in the tactics book in the suicide argument section, but this argument I've offered is not novel. There are a lot of people who have offered the same kind of argument. I actually got it first from J.P. Moreland. But the idea that rationality and knowledge being justified true belief, and justification entails the notion of reason, the idea that reason requires freedom is not unusual. It's just mere reflection, you can see that. You know, this issue is brought up by Stephen Hawking in his book, The Grand
Right.
Illusion, which strikes me as a kind of grand delusion in a certain way, because in his first chapter he says that physics rules everything and that philosophy is dead. And then he goes on for the next three chapters doing bad philosophy because he's denied the legitimacy of philosophy. It doesn't mean you don't do it. It just means you're probably going to do it badly. And he does. And he proclaims everything is determined because physics, strictly understood, if physics rules everything, then everything is determined. That's the way it works. It's all dominoes falling, and that's it. And the question I ask of Dr. Hawking in my critique of his analysis, and this was late last year, I think I wrote this as a solid ground, so you can get it on our website. My question of Professor Hawking is this. What accounts for the arrangement of the words on the pages of his own book? Does physics account for that? Because
right.
If a physics explains the arrangement of the ink on the page and the words in their order, then the book doesn't say anything. There is no information there. There's no communication. And he shouldn't be getting a royalty because he didn't deliberate in the sense of writing the book. He was just a domino falling in a complicated way that resulted in splotches of black on white paper. And this, of course, is absurd, and this is my point.
Yeah, I do seem to recall that. So on a more practical level, then, wouldn't determinism produce ideas like once a criminal, always a criminal, that sort of thing?
Well, no, I guess you could say, if I were a determinist, I'd say, well, no, the dominoes fall in this way, that they fall for a while making a person a criminal, and then they fall for a while making a person a good person. What you'd have to say as a determinist is, while he's a criminal, he's not responsible for that, because moral responsibility requires freedom. And when he's a good person, he's not responsible for that either, because moral responsibility requires freedom. Since there's no freedom in either case, then there can't be blame and there can't be praise. It doesn't make any sense.
Okay.
And by the way, B.F. Skinner, who is a behaviorist, which is a deterministic system, believed that, praise and blame were foolish because there were no free acts. You know, he's the behavioral psychologist from the 60s and 70s. I don't know if he's still alive.
That doesn't seem to make sense.
Beyond Freedom and Dignity is his book.
You know, it wouldn't seem to make sense because the praise and the blame would be an input into the...
Well, that's all one would have to... If all one is saying is that praise and blame are just mere actions and there's no true praise and true blame, like moral approbation for blame and moral applause for virtue, and you could get away with that. But people think they're acting as if praise and blame have moral content to them, and there isn't any room for that in a deterministic system. So I got to run here, Ed. All right, but it's good discussion on the issue, and I thank you for your call. Going to break? Yeah, we're going to break right now. I'll be back with more on Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg Kokel here, inviting you to a conference you won't soon forget. The location? The Eastern Caribbean. Join us as we set sail March 17th, 2012. From Fort Lauderdale, Florida, for 8 days aboard Holland America's MS Eurodam for an unforgettable trip to Grand Turks and Caicos Islands, San Juan, Puerto Rico, St. Thomas and the Virgin Islands, and Half Moon Cay in the Bahamas. I'll be joined by Stand to Reason Student Impact Director Brett Kunkel and STR speaker and trainer Alan Schliemann for a lineup of conference sessions that will stimulate your thinking and equip you with practical skills. Everything about this trip is being planned with your enjoyment and enrichment in mind. And this year we're planning some special youth sessions led by Brett, so plan on bringing the family and enjoying great times of fellowship and spiritual deepening together. Not only will you be challenged with stimulating presentations, you'll have a chance to ask questions in open forum discussions and enjoy the interaction and fellowship with both our speakers and your fellow passengers on deck, sharing great meals together and ashore as we enjoy the splendor of the Eastern Caribbean's beautiful resort ports. So save the dates and contact Inspiration Cruises and Tours. That's 800-247-1899. They're assisting Stand to Reason with their trip, and their skilled staff is committed to answering all your questions and helping to make this a memorable experience. You can also visit our website at str.org for all the information. I hope to see you there in the Caribbean with Stand to Reason.
Hi, this is Brett Kunkel. What do we do when our students doubt? What should be our response? And does Jesus have anything to say about doubt? Download my Bulletproof podcast this month to find out. Look for Bulletproof on iTunes or on the podcast page at str.org.
Want to know what's going on with STR? Greg's speaking events? What people are saying about STR resources? You can find STR on Facebook and follow STR on Twitter. Learn more about STR staff, post comments, and get involved with other like-minded Christians. On Facebook, you'll find the official Stand to Reason page, a Solid Ground fan page, and the STR Place Facebook home for student outreach. You can find them all connected at our official page. And finally, follow STR on Twitter at STR Tweets, where you can also engage other listeners live during the radio program using the hashtag STR Talk.
Greg Kokel back with you here on Stand to Reason, and time is waning. I want to get to the callers as fast as possible. Let's talk with Patrick in Napa Valley, California. Hi, Pat.
Hey, this is Patrick. I'm in Torrance.
Oh, you're in Torrance now? Well, you're from Napa. What are you doing here in Southern California?
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
This is your old friend, Pat Park.
I got you. I am sorry. And now you're just coming into clear vision right now.
Right.
Yeah,
it's
nice.
Been a while.
It has been a while, and it's good to talk with you, Pat.
Hey, just curious. I've been on hold for a while. It's enjoyable and excellent discussions on
Thanks.
Recent reasons.
What do you
think about the slogan, the radio slogan, the intersection of faith and reason?
Well, I actually
like that. Is that a, you like that? That's not a pastorism.
No, I actually thought it was clever. That's Frank Pastore's slogan from his show. And when he took over that particular post, that particular program is the most popular Christian talk show in the country, as I understand it. And and he's also a colleague, a graduate from the MA Phil program at Talbot. And when I heard that handle being expressed there, I thought, wow, this is great. You know, I knew Frank, and he has a good grasp on these issues, the politics, the rational basis for our spiritual convictions and everything. And so I thought it was a great way of putting it, the intersection of faith and reason. I think what that does is it emphasizes the compatibility of them and the friendly relationship between the two of them. So I thought that was pretty clever myself.
Okay. No, the only reason I brought that up, I was thinking while you were talking with Dr. Beckwith and so forth, I was thinking, doesn't that presuppose the dichotomy between, like you were talking about earlier, that there's this, on the one side you got faith, but contrary to that is reason.
Well, I would say it presupposes the distinction between them,
right.
Not if what you mean by dichotomy is that they're at opposite ends of the spectrum, and divorced is really the point. But there is a legitimate distinction, and Dave Horner's book characterizes that this way, that reason assesses and faith trusts, which I think is a really good – so you could say that the intersection of assessment and trusting, I mean, that they ought to intersect. In that sense, so yeah. I'm fine with that.
Okay, on to my question. I last night checked out YouTube because I was hearing the buzz about Ray Comfort's new 180 movie or documentary.
Right.
And as you know, I've been a longtime friend and supporter of Stand to Reason, and
right.
with people like Scott Klusendorf and
right.
so forth. Where does Stand to Reason stand with respect to this this new film put out by?
Well, we endorsed it. I actually saw it a couple of weeks or a month or so before it was made public, and I saw the clips for it, the teaser, which was very teasing, I should say. You know, it's a very
right.
it's clever. It's quintessential Ray Comfort. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
that's
a little bit exaggerating a little bit. It's a and I think not dishonest, but like a lot of teasers, it's meant to draw you in. And then when you get the whole thing, then you see how it all fits together. And the teaser is that, you know, in 35 to 50 seconds, these different people are changing their minds
right.
on abortion. And it's clear then when you see the 180 that there's a lot more that's going on, even though the change of mind happens in those cases rather quickly. It's because of the foundation that has been laid in the conversations with them for 15 or 20 minutes that sets them up for this question that Ray asks. And and I think it's very, very clever. It's very tactical in its approach. It certainly gets people thinking. I think one criticism of it might be that people are – some people might think that this is meant to be a training tool by which you adopt this methodology and go out there, and the criticism then is, well, you know, like Ray Comfort's clever in the way he does this. He can really maneuver carefully like this because he's done this so many times, and maybe a newbie can't do it the way he does it. And I think that's a fair criticism, but that's a fair observation, but I don't think it's a fair criticism because I don't know that this was intended to be a training tool. I think it was meant to be a standalone thing itself where you show other people, and then maybe you, if you are borderline yourself, you might be persuaded regarding the pro-life issue because of the kinds of points that Ray makes, or maybe other people that are at least open to considering it might be moved. And some of the people he interviews there weren't open to considering it at all, clearly, and pushed back pretty hard in at some points, but then ended up coming around. Now, how long those people will stay persuaded? I mean, this is open to discussion, but that's going to be true of any kind of persuasive device.
Right.
So on balance, I like it. We endorsed it, and we had actually our whole board watch it because I don't endorse something like that unless we have board approval. We don't endorse a lot of things, but there were I think plenty of good reasons to endorse it, and even though there might be some liabilities to it, modest things that people might object to or whatever, on balance I thought it was good.
Yeah, okay, good. That's you answered my question. That's what I was looking for. I'm actually, I ordered on Amazon a copy of it for myself, and I.
You haven't seen it yet, then, Pat?
No, I did see it last night. I watched the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
And I thought it. I thought it was well done, and cool. I've. You know, there's some theological differences between my position and his, but when it comes to law and gospel, and specifically with this one dealing with the pro-life persuasion, so I thought it was well done and funny.
Yeah, I agree. Exactly.
And I talked to a couple elders at my church, and I said, I want to present this thing, you know, on a Saturday men's day, and they're looking into it, and I wanted to get your take. And there was one thing, I'm sure if it, because it is getting a lot of noise and discussion. It just came out recently.
Yeah, well, he's very clever in his PR. I got to hand it to him. He knows how to get things out and get the buzz going. And it's not a criticism. It's just is one of his gifts. And I'm glad that there's a buzz about this thing because it's well done.
Somebody like Dennis Prager is going to hear this or maybe even do a segment on it. I don't know. It's hard
that
to tell.
Be.
But you know how he holds to the position where there's no moral equivalence between the two. And I think in this DVD or this documentary, I think
you're talking about the moral equivalence now with regards to the Nazi Holocaust and what's happening.
Yeah, that was the one issue that I think is getting, that is the issue that's getting a lot of attention.
Well, you know, by the way, that's a fair kind of complaint to raise because that is the parallel that's being drawn there. But I think they're careful in making the parallel. And in fact, what is the question that Ray asks there? This is the kind of, you know, $64,000 question. Is it, when is it right to kill a baby? Is that the question? When is it okay to kill a, how does he put it?
He simply asks, give me an example, or is there any time it's okay to kill a baby in the womb?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know if it says in the womb. That's right. I'm getting instruction here from Alan Schliemann, who also saw this. He's in studio with me. Finish the sentence. It's okay to kill a baby when?
Yeah, there it is.
There it is. That's it. That is clever. I mean, that's really clever.
I was actually thinking of you guys at Stand to Reason when he asked that question. I went, I haven't heard this from Coco.
Well, you know, and what he does with the whole Nazi Holocaust thing is to morally sensitize them to the issue of the cheapening of human life. I'm not sure if he's even how much he could be accused of drawing a equivalence there between the two. But there is certainly a kinship, arguably, in that going through the one, I think, is meant to morally sensitize people because people were insensitive, at least at that time, with regards to the Holocaust of the Jews, many people who are participating in it, even though it's obviously immoral. And so we've got a similar insensitivity now. And so he's trying to link those two together. Now, since you mentioned this issue about the Holocaust, I actually wrote a piece on this years ago answering the challenge of whether abortion is a Holocaust or not. And it goes to the issue, and you can find this on our website, I'm sure. It's Is Abortion a Holocaust, I think, is the title of it. So you can go to str.org and look it up. But it's a very simple argument. What is a Holocaust? A Holocaust is a massive destruction of human beings, and especially an immoral one, one that's not morally defensible. So, you know, not all wars, though they have massive destruction of human lives, are Holocausts in that sense. This is where singling out people and executing them. And certainly the Nazi Holocaust was one. But then that raises the question, is abortion wrong? And if it's wrong, then why is it wrong? Well, it's wrong because it's wrong to take the life of an innocent human being. Now, when you take millions, if it turns out that abortion does take the life of an innocent human being, and we offer the arguments for that, then how can one say that abortion is not a Holocaust in the same sense that the Jewish Holocaust was a Holocaust? Now, what we're not saying is that the suffering that was experienced is the same, and we are not saying they are morally equivalent, because I think the Jewish Holocaust was worse because of the additional element of suffering that was part of that massive extermination of Jews.
Yeah, and I think that's Dennis's argument. Yeah.
Yes, and I think we need to be clear about that. But that doesn't mean then that abortion is not a Holocaust, because a Holocaust doesn't entail necessarily the brutal enslavement of human beings and the torture of human beings and the ultimate death of human beings. Maybe just collecting them together and killing them en masse is still a Holocaust. If all of those Jews had been treated very kindly and ushered into the gas chambers and then gassed and killed virtually instantaneously, that would not have taken away from the charge that that was a Holocaust. And if that's the case, then when that happens to millions of unborn children, then that can be properly considered a Holocaust as well. Fair enough?
Sounds good.
Pat, thank I got to run. Time. I'm against a hard break here, but nice to talk to you again, and thanks for calling back
okay.
in.
Take care.
All Bye-bye. The best. Okay, Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, more to come. We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org. or call 1-800-2-REASON.
My name's Alan Schliemann, but recently I was introduced as Saeed Ibn Umar to a group of Christians who thought I was a real Muslim. During my role play, I fired off the most common Islamic arguments to see if they were prepared to answer the Muslim challenge. Find out how they did in this month's podcast, Thinking Out Loud with Alan Schliemann. Look for it on iTunes or the podcast page at str.org.
Now you can take STR with you through the new apps for iPhone, Android, and iPad. Available for free from iTunes or the Android market, you can listen to STR podcasts, check the STR blog, and access timely and practical resources on many subjects, including the latest Solid Ground, Greg's mentoring letter, and much, much more. You can also follow STR on Twitter and Facebook through the Connect section of the new app. Designed and created by the group that has created apps for some of the largest Christian organizations and churches, you'll be pleased with the clean layout, the great features and functionality of the STR apps. And did we say it's free? So download the app today through iTunes and start carrying STR with you everywhere you take your phone. And let us know how you like the new STR app by posting a review on iTunes or the Android market. Just one more way that STR is seeking to increase your knowledge, wisdom, and character.
Stand to Reason, the place for straightforward, no frills, nothing buttery, real, believable Christianity. Let's go quickly to the calls again. And in Seattle, that would be Sasuke. Did I say it right?
Sasuke.
Sasuke, okay.
Hey, before I start, we actually met this summer. I hate to do this to you. I did it when I was there, but I was wearing a pink shirt. I don't know if you remember, and you certainly don't have to. But
where?
When you were at Calvary in Olympia.
The pink-shirted guy doesn't stand out. Let's just put
that's
it
okay.
that way.
It was pleasant.
Although there are not many pink shirts on guys nowadays. I have
that's
noticed
true,
that.
Yeah,
but it just,
true.
You know, I... Oh, here's... Yeah, okay. What's on your mind?
So I was just, I guess, looking for some tip or guidance, I guess. Like, so I serve as a leader for the 9 a.m. greeters at my church.
Uh-huh.
And before we go out, usually the group leaders have a little moment to share, you know, whatever's on their mind and stuff. And I was thinking that would be a good opportunity to use to, like, introduce the group members to, like, apologetics.
Uh-huh.
Not necessarily a sense of, like, trying to teach them how to, you know, argue the ontological.
Right.
Arguing for God's existence. But just like,
that's not
a
good place to start.
Exactly, exactly.
That's not even a good place to end.
I have to share truth about the Bible beyond, like, the scope of the Bible, more like natural theology, I guess, if that makes sense. And I don't really have a ton of time. I have, like, maybe 7-10 minutes max.
Yeah, right.
And I guess how to do that effectively, maybe what resources, or how to do that without, like, getting into... I guess I'm just trying to, like, build... Ultimately, I'd like to build an enthusiasm for apologetics.
Sure, sure.
Like,
okay.
Vacuum.
Yeah. Well, it's a tricky problem to solve, particularly somebody who hasn't kind of done a lot of this before.
Yeah.
I think what you need, if you were to do these things, you want to think about what little exercise can you give them that will allow you, them to have a little involvement back and forth, but then at the same time allow you to kind of give the moral of the story at the end of it. All right. And I mean, 10 minutes, it's not real long, but it is a chunk of time that you could do something productive with. I guess if I were starting that right now, I would think about this faith knowledge or faith reason equation.
That's very good, actually.
I'd want to toss out a question. Maybe the first question would be just kind of a show of hands. How many people think that faith and reason are somewhat opposed to each other? So when you're, you know, you have knowledge and reason on the one hand, then you have faith on the other hand. Okay, just to get a sense, get people thinking about it, and then say, okay, I want you to break up in groups, and I want you to come up with definition of reason and definition of faith, and you got 2 minutes to do that or something. Three, and then the next 2 minutes or 3 minutes, you're asking them to share their definitions. Because I have a feeling if people are careful, if they're forced to think about this, chances are some of them are going to come up with pretty decent definitions on both sides, and then you could just compare them. Say, where is the conflict here? And if you go back to my discussion earlier when I talked about David Horner's book, which you might want to get, it's called Mind Your Faith. Is that it? Yeah, Mind Your Faith, InterVarsity Press. Because he discusses this and he talks about faith and reason being married to each other rather than divorced from each other, and that faith, or rather, reason assesses and faith trusts. Reason assesses and faith trusts. And the moral of the story is that you're going for, and this is where your skill as a group leader is going to come in, is you're trying to help them to see these are the biblical ways of understanding, and that if you understand them correctly, they don't compete. We can see how having a proper assessment of something allows us then to trust with confidence.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that would be my first segment with them, and then maybe go from there. And that ought to stimulate some interaction.
Can I also like throw in like a sub question here? I
sure.
Guess? Would you say it's necessary to, I've been listening to apologetics for like the past, pretty much since I became a Christian about 6 years ago.
Okay.
So,
good for you.
Like, I would like to say, and I don't want to sound like an egomaniac, but I feel like I, to a degree, have heard pretty much every issue, I guess.
You are so egotistical.
Not in depth, but I'm pretty familiar. Like, I don't think I would hear something that would be surprising.
Yeah, okay.
I don't necessarily think that I can give an exhaustive answer.
Mm-hmm.
I know a lot of resources, like if a person did have a question, but do you think it's necessary to be, I guess, how much should you know?
You know enough. I'm just telling you right now, you know enough.
Okay.
You know more than enough to do what we're talking about.
Okay.
I started doing apologetics I was a year and a half old in the Lord or something like that before I started participating in the instruction of it. And I didn't know hardly anything.
Yeah,
but I there's a delta factor when you think, you know what delta is in like math.
Oh, I don't actually. Is that like a little symbol?
I think
like
it's change,
yellow?
Right? It's change. It's the difference.
Okay, definitely.
Okay, the difference between one another. So when I say delta factor, I'm talking about the difference between the teacher and the one who's being taught. The teacher always knows more than one's being taught, presumably. But you don't have to know a lot. You just have to know more, and you pass that on to them.
Okay.
Now, as you grow, you get more and more, and the delta factor is increasing, you know, that is, you know more than a lot of people, but that just means you have more to pass on. What it doesn't mean is you have to have a big delta factor in order to pass something on. You just have to have a delta factor.
Yeah.
And as long as you, in fact, this was key to me growing as a Christian and communicating with other people about things, that that what was key to me is being able to take what I had and bloom where I was planted. And sometimes I didn't have much, but the fact that I began using what I had solidified those things in my own mind more effectively for me. I began to understand them more. In fact, we were just talking earlier during the break with some friends in the studio here about when I first started radio. And when I think about it, radio actually was huge for me in increasing my ability to think about things and to understand things, because that was 22 years ago. What did I know then? Almost nothing compared to what I know now. But the fact that I was in the harness and I was dealing with people and answering questions as best as I could at that time, this really had the effect of ramping me up in my knowledge and understanding, and got me into the books and got me thinking about things and forced me to articulate things that I hadn't and work through things that I hadn't worked through. So there's a process here. You got to get into the harness for a lot of this stuff to happen. And if you're saying, well, I don't know enough yet to get into the harness, then you're not going to ever learn it.
And then I guess just finally, because I know you probably have 10 other callers left and not much
time. We're short on time, but that's okay. I got 2 minutes, so go ahead.
Okay, just really quick then. Do you think it would be helpful to maybe just like go through a book, like say On Guard, and just read snippets from, or something that you guys have like a resource?
Don't buy Bill Craig's books. Buy Mike's books, okay?
Honestly, I think yours would be a lot more practical for that.
Well, I think his are practical. I'm just joking, obviously. On Guard is a book that I haven't actually read that book, but he's written this and developed it specifically for the purposes that you're discussing. And his stuff is really good, but for some people it may be a little bit hard.
Sell On Guard
No, actually I don't think we have it in our library right now, but just go to Amazon or something like that. But I think that's a good place to start. Okay. There are other video tools. We have a thing on relativism, for example. It's a group discussion kind of thing that you might want to consider. A lot of folks use the ABCs. This is a more ambitious because we got 15 CDs there in the set that they play and talk and with and do. The tactics DVDs are sensational. Now they're not 10-minute segments, but these are things that people have been making use of all over the country in conjunction with the book, and that's a plug and play. And I'm the talking head, so it's easy on you guys to do that. And I think the tactics instruction is central. It's foundational. You heard accurately.
I
just think it really is foundational. It's going to help people get into play and to do so in a much more relaxed way, and therefore I think more effective way. So we do have things that are available to you for the kinds of purposes that you're describing. And but the other people have good stuff too. And On Guard, Bill developed it just for this purpose. I'm sure it's fine, and you'll have to decide whether it's best for your group. You're welcome. I appreciate it, and I won't say your name again because I know I'll butcher it, but in Seattle. Oh, good to have you call. And look at on our website, our featured article is called 100% God, 100% Man. It's my response to the question of what is the relationship in ministry and in life to God's involvement, to our involvement, str.org. Go there and read that. I think you'll find some things that will be helpful for you. That's all the time we have for our local network here at KBRT in Southern California. The rest of the station, stay with us. We'll be taking more calls after the break until the top of the hour. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven this week, my friends.
You've been listening to Stand to Reason. Our podcasts and radio program are made possible by friends of this ministry through their generous support. You can support STR by making a gift online at str.org.